This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Danger! Danger!
It's not a lineup, it's not an army, it's not a stable, and it's not a family. It's an alliance of businessmen.
Take it right.
Place to Be Nation, you're listening to the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast, featuring a different way to look at and debate the history of wrestling. And now, your co-host, the PTBN PWO two-man power trip, JT and Will.
The Dangerous Alliance would rather die than surrender to you.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to episode 2 of the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast, and we are very excited to bring this installment your way. I am one of your co-hosts here, JT, Justin from Place to Be Nation, and with me as always, my tag team partner, my cohort here in the Dangerous Alliance, good old Will from Texas. Will, how you doing?
Hey, what's up, JR?
Been looking forward to this for 2 weeks now. I was ready to do episode 2 the next night. I was so jacked up after that first one.
I am, and I just want to give a shout out to one of the listeners who said that he felt that this podcast was the future of wrestling podcast. And so if we're there to kickstart that, then I'm glad to be a part of it.
There you go. I'm down too, and I look forward to it. And of course, with us as always is Dan McGinn, running the board, running the numbers and the clock for us. Dan, how are you?
I'm good, fellas. How are you? It's amazing it's only been 2 weeks since the last time we all got together.
I know, right? And we have to put a clock. Like, I just want Dan to send us random day and hour updates between episodes, Will, via text. What do you think about that? So, like 10 days, 8 days.
I already get enough texts from my wife as it is talking about the hour of the day, so I don't need any more.
And Basil's with us as well, I hear, so that's good. Of course, Dan, we have some news maybe we can talk about a little bit later, a little tease we'll get to. But first up, Will, why don't we dive right in? As always, we're going to be doing 3 exercises here tonight and then some mail from our listeners. So, Dan McGinn, lay it on us. What is exercise number 1?
The choice is yours.
You can get with this or you can get with that. You can get with this or you can get with that. You can get with this or you can get with that.
All right, fellas, our first fall tonight is called draft time. What are we drafting? We're drafting 1985.
And it's not just a standalone draft like you may hear many other of our great podcasts here at Place of Nation. So, Will, what we're doing is we are drafting in 3-year arcs throughout history. So every time we do this is going to be continuation in 3-year periods. So starting tonight, we're going to do 1985, and we're building a promotion that needs to be successful over the next 3 years. So next time we do draft time as a fall, it'll be 1986 and then 1987. We'll have different parameters as we move through each of those. So the goal tonight is to take 10 picks each, must be at least 8 single stars. You can take a maximum of 2 tag teams if you desire. You don't have to take a tag team. But if you want, you can only take 2. You must explain quickly the intent on how you plan to utilize the star. And we'll move in a snake-style draft. Dan's going to flip a coin in a moment. So whoever gets the first pick, the next person gets 2 and 3, and then the other one gets 4 and 5. We go back and forth like that. Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair are not eligible and do not exist in our universe. So they're the 2 alpha dogs, 1 from each promotion. We felt like it'd be a little bit more challenging if we didn't have them at our disposal. So maybe down the line they'll show up. But as of right now, they do not exist. We are only drafting North American competitors. They had to have competed in North America in that year. Doesn't mean that they have to be from North America, but they had to have competed on North American soil. When you draft someone, you get how they are for that 3-year stretch. You do not have to use them how they're used in real life. So for example, if Hulk Hogan were eligible and Will took him, he does not have to keep him as real American Hulk Hogan. He can do whatever he wants. But you do get him for the years of 85 through 87, basically how he was at that time. So, you know, physical condition, experience in the business. So, for example, if one of us, say, takes Bret Hart, you can't just assume he's Bret Hart 1995. You have to assume he's the Bret Hart that existed in 1985, but you can utilize him however you want. When you draft someone, like I said, you get him for that time period. In the following 2 years, we'll be dropping guys along with drafting other ones. And like I said, we're going to take 8 singles and 2 tags. Will, did I miss anything in here?
Nah, man, sounds good. It's like the rules of the draft took our half-hour segment.
Well,
so
good thing
what's fall number two?
The clock didn't start yet, so we're lucky. Dan, why don't you flip the coin, and then when you tell us who has the number one pick, you can start the clock.
All right, coin is ready.
All right, Will, I'll let you call. You're the road team here.
We'll do heads.
It is heads.
All right, Will, with the number one pick, Dan, start the clock, and we are underway.
All right. Well, for my number one pick, I'm going to pick a guy who is versatile. He's a superstar in his own right. He can play face or heel and be inserted however I need him, and that's going to be Randy the Macho Man Savage.
Wow, not where I thought you were headed, and that was a little upset. That's who I was going to take there. Not happy. So what I'm going to do, well, do you want to talk a bit how you plan? Well, you mentioned he's versatile out of the game.
Yeah,
face heel.
I think it's more important that we get our 10 picks down, and then we can talk about our ideas after we see who we have for our promotion.
All right.
Because right? if I plan on booking him against somebody right now and you pick him, I can't book him. So I think we should talk about that after we do our picks.
All right. Well, because you took my favorite guy and my pick, I'm going to go ahead and land a blow to you. I'm taking Jerry the King Lawler out of Memphis, a guy in you talked about in great depth in the 80s in our last episode, how much you loved him at number one. I think you can use him as a face or heel if I run in the Memphis area. If I decide to be a Southern-based promotion, he'll be my guy on top. And what I'm thinking is, if I'm leaning towards having him as a face like he was in that time period, I could use a guy who would be a tremendous heel, but also could turn face if I need him to, because he's so good at being a heel, he's going to get himself over as a face, and that's Roddy Piper.
Heat Machine. That's excellent choice.
Heat Machine in 85, and a guy that had just enough, a good amount of experience at that point, but was still really in his prime as well. So those are my first two picks, Jerry Lawler, Roddy Piper.
Good choices. For my second pick, I'm going to go with a guy who could also play face or heel. We saw this feud in 1988, and that's Randy Savage versus Ted DiBiase. But roles could be reversed in 85. It could be babyface DiBiase versus heel Savage, or it could be that babyface Savage coming up. He's going to be the linchpin of my promotion against the King Rat, Ted DiBiase.
Man, I was debating DiBiase and Lawler, and I knew you'd take Lawler, so I was hoping maybe DiBiase would slip by, but I didn't think he would. Tough loss there.
And so to ensure that I have a white-hot babyface that plays the role, that can draw the women in, that can draw the kids in, I'm going to take a surefire baby face, always getting cheers at this point in time. Ricky the Dragon Steamboat is my number three.
All right, can't argue with that roster at all to this point. So very solid three picks. And I'm going to go with a guy with my third pick who, at this point, is in that Steamboat role and we know would really start to reach his, I don't want to say peak, because I think he was still good after that, but really one of his best years as a breakthrough star in 1987 is Barry Windham, a guy that I can slot into that pure babyface role. Very good. Had a good tag run with Rotundo in 85, then jumped back home, went to Florida, then to Crockett, and of course had the series with Ric Flair in 87 where he really started to break out. So I'm going to take
amazing pick.
Take a Windham there mainly for his future stock over the next 3 years. A young guy I can work with. And you know what? Piper needs a running buddy. He needs another heel, but a guy that is a little bit different than him too. So if they come to odds, it can lead to some good maybe heel feuds, or a guy that Piper can be set up to turn face against. And that is Tully Blanchard, who had another great run 85 to 87, of course, with his feud with Magnum TA and the I Quit match and then the Four Horsemen. So another pure heel. So I feel like I've picked four versatile guys that can all work and also can go face or heel as I need in Lawler, Piper, Windham, and Tully.
Man, you killed my Tully Blanchard Arn Anderson tag team vision.
Good.
Okay, but that's okay, because I'm going to take the biggest tag team of the 80s. I need some guys to draw, some guys to strike fear into the heart of my biggest heels, or if I were to keep them heel or turn them heel in some parts of the country, and that's Animal and Hawk, the Road Warriors, led by Paul Ellering. Have to pick the Road Warriors. There are other tag teams I like better, but I'm thinking box office. Mm-hmm. I have to compete with your mega promotion. I'm going with the Road Warriors for my next pick. And then a guy, I don't want you to have all of the best heels, okay, because you already got Piper and Blanchard locked up. So I'm going to pick a guy who could still work. He could still fight technical matches if you need him to be. He's a guy who could beat the shit out of you if you needed him to, and that's Greg the Hammer Valentine.
Great pick, especially in 85. Just
in 85, that's yeah. Right. Because I guarantee you he will not be drafted 80, man, maybe 1990 after, you know, he's out.
And that is a great segue for my fifth pick, Will, because I'm taking his arch nemesis, and this was my plan to hopefully grab him around this area. And one of my favorites, a guy that I always liked growing up, but going back and rewatching some of the stuff when I had 30-24-7, kind of rewatching house shows and prime times and whatnot, it's Tito Santana. Another pure baby face to go on that side, a guy that could deliver, you know, a great 7-minute match or a great 30-minute match as needed. Had some really wars with Valentine pick. In 85.
Makes me mad because, you know, I was going to pick Tito to feud with Greg. It's okay. It's okay. That's why we do this, man.
Well, you made my next pick a little bit easier because I was really tempted to do the Tito Valentine pair as well. But I'm going to take another one who I think is probably on your radar because I think he was in your top five. And this is the guy I'm planning on having a great feud with Lawler on top to really hook the diehards in the 80s. And that's Terry Funk. Had a great feud, of course, in WWF with Hulk Hogan, some of the Funk Brothers stuff, and then headed back, I believe, overseas after that. But I'm going to take the old man, the crazy old man, Terry Funk, to round out my first six picks here.
You know what? I didn't have him on my radar. I completely left Funk off my radar, man. And mainly because I look at Funk and, like, I don't really have a soft spot for that WWF run that he did. And so I kind of look at, like, out of sight, out of mind from, right. like, 1983 till 89. And so, no, that's a good pick, though. You know, Funk is very active, very great.
I think it's funny because if you read these to someone, like, blindly, they'd definitely say, this is your roster and you have mine. Without
Maybe.
A doubt.
Well, you know what, man? I'm going to lock in my second tag team because I value tag team wrestling.
That's good.
And these are guys that could wrestle against any face team you put them against. So if I want to pair face DiBiase and Steamboat against these guys, it'll work. If I want to pair Savage and Steamboat, my great faces against these guys, it'll work. Plus, they have one of the best managers ever to come along with them. That's Bobby Eaton and Dennis Condrey, the original Midnight Express.
Great pick there.
So, plus, it's proven. If anyone can get a decent match out of the Road Warriors, these are the guys to do it. So, you know, I always can go that route too.
And I love that you did you exhausted your tag teams because now I can sit back, wait a little bit, and I know the two I want.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I value tag team wrestling. I think that it's something that is overlooked. Now I get another pick, right? Because we're snaking.
Yes, we're snaking.
Okay. Damian. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, I am going to pick another super babyface, a guy who, if you would have just been a little bit more sober, a little bit more cleaned up, and I'm hoping. Since I'm taking him away from Daddy's territory, and I'm hoping that, you know, he's away from his brother's negative influence here. You know, we got people like DiBiase and Steamboat to kind of watch over him. I don't know. Kerry Von Erich. Guys, I'm a little older than you. I lived in Texas during the peak of the Von Erichs. This guy was so over. He was so beloved. And, you know, the whole thing with their family is a big tragedy. But Kerry Von Erich could wrestle with the best of them. He had classic matches against Flair, against Lawler, against Chris Adams, against Michael Hayes. All of the Freebirds, really. Guy had great matches with One Man Gang and Kamala when nobody was doing that. So props to Kerry Von Erich, man. Another hot baby face to sell my territory to.
I thought you were headed towards David San Martino there with the build-up daddy's territory.
No. Yeah, San Martino probably won't make either of our lists. I'm just predicting that right
85
now.
85 is a big year for him. All right, so with my number, what are we up to, 7 here? Number 7 pick, I want a name value. I want the draw that you've been talking about, the Road Warriors and a couple of the other guys to get people in the building, sell some tickets. The legendary Andre the Giant, I think a pretty good value here in the 7th round. a guy, exiting towards his, physical prime, but could still get by on his wiles and his experience, and was still such a presence. And just kind of have some, I picture a feud with him and, underdog babyface Barry Windham or something like that. If I want to turn Andre heel.
Cannot deny the drawing power of Andre the Giant and the presence. Yeah.
And even matching with him and Funk could be fun.
Yeah. And Piper's right there as an antagonist. I mean, yeah, you're right on track. Who's your next pick, bud?
20 minutes.
Thanks, Dan. I'm going a little off my out of my comfort zone a bit, heading up north to the AWA to take their top guy in this time period, Nick Bockwinkel.
Oh, man, I can't believe that.
Another top heel to bring in, a different kind of heel than the guys I already have. I have the pretty boy heel now. I have the asshole heel on Piper, and now I got the smart guy, super intellectual heel in Bockwinkel. So I think, again, adding to the versatility, and a guy that could work face is needed as well. A lot of experience comes in, brings his fan base from the AWA in Minneapolis down here with me. So feeling good.
Yeah, no, and you know what, man? I did not pick Nick in those first things because I was hoping the guy was off your radar. You know what I mean? I was hoping your WWF bias would be blind to the greatness of Bockwinkel. Man, that is an excellent pick.
Best talent available, Will. That's where I'm going.
I got you. Another guy, look, anyone who knows about marketing in the 80s knows this guy. He's a guy who could work. He's a guy who could work face or heel. But I'm probably going to have him face for a while to capitalize off of his G.I. Joe action figure run, and that's Sergeant Slaughter.
Nice.
Yeah, so we're gonna make sure that Slaughter here gets a nice run to kind of carry off of that 1984 Iron Sheik feud. Here's a guy who could fight Savage if Savage is heel, or he could be the heel against the face DiBiase, or face Steamboat, or face Kerry, or he could be the face against Greg Valentine.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sergeant Slaughter is my next pick. And then I'm going to go with another heel. And this guy could be a babyface too. That's the great thing about this roster. Is that I need a guy who, I need him to break an arm, he can break somebody's arm. He could be that guy. Him and Greg Valentine can be the bone breakers. You know, like Valentine broke Wahoo's leg. This guy broke Dr. Death's arm in UWF. We're talking about Dirty Dick Murdoch, because I have a feeling after 85 through 87 – nobody's going to be drafting Dick Murdoch. So I got to take Dick Murdoch once again to fill that role of being able to be either a heel or face.
All right. So I got two more left, and I haven't taken any tag teams yet. So my strategy here paid off a bit because the two teams I wanted to grab. Both on the surface come in as face teams. And, one of these teams I was a little bit hoping you would take, so it allowed me to take one of my other favorites, but... I can't pass up the Rock and Roll Express here in 1985. Again, pure baby faces.
Yep.
When you look at some of the guys I picked, definitely looking like more of a Southern style roster. So I think the Rock and Roll Express slot in beautifully here. And then my final pick is another tag team, which will be the British Bulldogs. Again, a team like you mentioned.
I knew it.
You've mentioned a few times, Will, guys that probably won't get drafted, past this initial period. And that's obviously Dynamite Kid. So I wanted to take the Bulldogs. And I was really torn here because I really wanted to take the Hart Foundation too. And it came down to them and the Rock and Roll Express. And I just feel like the Express were so... the Hart Foundation can get taken in plenty of other years. The Express was really at their peak in the NWA in 85. So I wanted to get them to work with some of these other guys. And then the Bulldogs to me were so good in 85 and 86 that it was hard to pass them up.
Okay, well, I'm going to make my final pick. And this is hard. Okay, because there's three guys I really want to pick in this slot. Okay, but I have to pick this guy only because he's so versatile in the ring. I have enough baby faces where I need a good old fashioned heel who can team with Dick Murdoch. He can team with Greg Valentine. He could team with the heel DiBiase or a heel Savage, and that's the Enforcer, Arn Anderson. And that's my final pick.
Nice. And I think that's great value. I mean, to get Arn Anderson 85 in round 10, really a 20th overall pick.
Well, Arn's not, to me, Arn's a guy that he's not going to sell tickets like the Road Warriors, right? Like he's not going to be the draw like them. He's not going to be a draw like a Kerry Von Erich or Randy Savage. But he's a guy who's going to make all of those guys look good in the ring, you know?
Absolutely.
And so, you know, I'm looking at our rosters here, JR. Right now you've got Lawler, Piper, Wyndham, Santana, Blanchard, Funk, Andre, Bockwinkel, the Rock and Roll, and the Bulldogs. Now, you have two face tag teams. Mm-hmm. Who are you gonna pair them up against?
15 minutes.
Well, I mean, the Bulldogs on the surface have always been face, but they did have a heel run, I believe, was it in Japan and also in Stampede, right? They were heels.
They could play heel. Dynamite Kid is a perfect asshole, yes.
And I'm also picturing like you'd use Tully and Piper, like I said, maybe as a team initially, a loosely affiliated team, and then eventually I'm picturing Piper going face off of that. Lawler Funk, I think, would be kind of my first main event level program. With Andre doing kind of the established veteran thing, maybe where he's friendly with Barry Windham, takes him under his wing, and then Andre eventually turns, gets under the tutelage of a manager. Barry has to prove himself against the Giant, and maybe that launches Barry into the role that many thought he could eventually hit, and that is kind of that Hulk Hogan level role that he just never really fulfilled the promise on. So those would kind of be just eyeballing this quickly. And then even, that leaves over Tito and Bockwinkel, which would be a really fun second-level feud. Kind of the smart heel against the fiery babyface.
That's not even second-level for me, man, because Bockwinkel is so amazing. That to me, you said, maybe the other feud is the championship match.
Right.
But this is marquee. This could headline. Because Tito is such a great wrestler, such a great underrated wrestler well.
Especially at this point, so good.
Yeah, and so to me, man, I'm digging your territory, man. I'm looking forward to the dog collar chain matches between Piper and Lawler.
There you go.
You don't have Valentine for him, and I'm looking that if, I mean, you've already got Barry Windham versus Tully Blanchard locked in, right? I mean, that's a ready made feud. If you need to, you can have Ricky Morton have that little hot singles run that he had in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
So you can plug Ricky Morton in. I mean, could you imagine that? Face Ricky Morton versus heel Dynamite Kid with a healthy Dynamite. This isn't the Dynamite that gets knocked off the apron at number two and screws his back up, right? This is a healthy Dynamite.
Yeah, because Dynamite didn't really get hurt until, 87-ish? So I'm getting at least two.
Oh, 86 at WrestleMania 2.
Oh, is that when he
remember did? That's when
that's right.
They knocked him off the he was like jumping up and down on the turnbuckle, and then, got knocked off.
At least get a year and a half of strong Dynamite until he starts to taper. But even, I feel like it wasn't until 87 when they dropped the tag titles when he was really hurting, and maybe Davey had to like carry him out on his back and everything all like that. But
right.
So
could you imagine like the xenophobic Southern Ricky Morton promos talking about how he's doing it for America, and during the Declaration of Independence signing, we signed that thing to keep tyrants like you away, and just
I'm picturing too the xenophobia the opposite way with Bockwinkel wrestling Tito and. Slipping in the Mexican jokes and everything like that, or derisive comments.
Oh man,
on that level too. So,
but doing it in an educated manner,
exactly.
Right?
Yep.
Oh man, maybe they can have like a forum on immigration or something. And I didn't even think about that, man. What are you going to do with your top faces? Like who's Barry Windham?
Lawler's my top face right now. And I picture Wyndham as that up-and-comer. Kind of like he loses a couple hard luck matches, learning on the fly. Like I said, maybe he's under Andre's tutelage for a while. Andre's kind of teaching him the ropes as the veteran from all over. Barry looks up to him. One of the reasons I got in the business, you came down to Florida when I was a kid and I watched you and I got in the business. And then Andre eventually turns on him.
Nice.
And Barry's going to come up and fight through that. I think Lawler, Piper, and... Funk is in there as well as kind of my, top three main guys with Lawler, maybe the face fighting off both those guys as champion. So that'd probably be where I head first with them.
Okay. Well, let's check out some of my feuds here.
Let's do it. So let me run down your roster for you. You got Randy Savage, Ted DiBiase, Ricky Steamboat, a tremendous top three. Road Warriors, Greg Valentine, Midnight Express, Kerry Von Erich, Sergeant Slaughter, Dick Murdoch, and Arn Anderson. So again, a lot of versatility here, Will. Who are you? You talked about maybe doing a Savage DiBiase feud. Now that you've fleshed out the rest of your roster, do you still see those guys as your kind of top dogs here, or do you picture other ones being in the title picture?
For my first feud, yes, because Ted DiBiase, pre-Million Dollar Man, when he was the King Rat in Mid-South, he was the glue that held Mid-South together in the sense is that he's the guy who's going to get great match-of-the-decade contenders out of Jim Hacksaw Duggan. You know, he's a guy who fought a very young, very green Magnum TA to some great matches in 1984. This is truly one of the best brawlers. And Savage can brawl. That's what I like. You want these guys to get on the mat? Probably okay. But, you know, you can also get these guys to brawl. You can put them in cage matches. You can put them in gimmick matches. You can put them in 2 out of 3 falls matches. They're going to produce for you, right?
10 minutes.
And Savage has that star quality. So, to me, I'm thinking Savage is my star.
Yep.
You know, that's why I picked him over Lawler, because, quite frankly, as much as I think Jerry Lawler is the best of all time, Randy Savage has the most star power out of anybody on any of these lists.
Yeah, I will obviously not debate you on that one. So, you got my money.
Yeah, so Randy Savage versus Ted DiBiase in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I'm hoping that their matches are much better in a work rate friendly promotion, okay? Maybe a Southern promotion than it would be in Star Spangled Cartoon Land WWF, like the 1988 Million Dollar Man feud. You know, wasn't a fan of that feud, but I'm hoping in '85 it is a big success. And even if it's not, I got people to sub, you know, I get to switch because this would be my opening card to try and draw people in. Are you ready for this?
Yeah. And this is good. Hold on, because I want a headline. Give me your opening card. I'll go back and give mine. And then we're going to ask Dan, which of these cards would he attend on night one of both of these promotions?
There you go.
Okay.
My first opening match is going to be a technical affair. We're ending with some shenanigans, Ricky Steamboat versus Arn Anderson.
Like it.
And that's the opener.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to put a couple of grizzled veterans in there. Like I said, this guy's hot. He has the G.I. Joe line, and they're both brawlers. These are both guys who can punch you in the mouth, and you're going to feel it. So you're not going to have the technical contest that was in the opening match. You're going to have Sergeant Slaughter versus Dick Murdoch in a nasty, bloody brawl affair. Then you're going to have the Midnight Express versus the Road Warriors as your tag team attraction right there. Kerry versus Greg Valentine. Kerry Von Erich can go 30 with anybody. If you want him to have a good technical contest, so can Valentine. If you want to see these guys beat the crap out of each other, both of them can do that too. So depending on how the matches were laid out earlier in the night, you could sway either way. Right? And so that's your co-main event, maybe for your U.S. title or for the Will Inter-American title or something. I don't know. And then, of course, the headline, Randy Savage versus Ted DiBiase in 1985. Like I said, we're talking King Rat Ted DiBiase versus Macho Man Randy Savage. That's my card. So what's your card? I'm excited to hear this.
All right, so I'm running just 4 matches here. So I'm going to go 2 tag team matches on my opening night, but one of them's going to be a 2 out of 3 fall. So we're opening with Tito Santana versus Nick Bockwinkel. Bock cuts a big promo to start, you know, rides down Tito and his heritage and everything like that. Tito comes out on fire. Bock steals the win, though, at the end of the
match.
That's
strong to put Bock in your opening match, man.
Opening the card on fire there. And then we go for our work rate with the British Bulldogs versus the Rock and Roll Express in a best 2 out of 3 falls match to determine the first ever JRWF tag team champions here. And they're friendly still at this point. We have no heel face delineation. Both teams are friendly. So they kind of work a little bit of match. You know, a little testy towards the third fall, but the Rock and Roll Express steal the win on the Bulldogs. Morton rolls up Dynamite at the end and then run off with the titles, and the Bulldogs look a little bit frustrated, but still, again, both teams' faces. And then I got buddies here, Barry Windham with his idol, Andre the Giant, the guy, the reason he got in the business, the guy that he's dreamed of being his tag team partner forever. They're teaming up against Roddy Piper and Tully Blanchard. But
Hold on. Are we ignoring the fact that Barry Windham's dad was a wrestler and Barry grew up in the business?
Yes, because he wasn't sure what he wanted to do until Andre came by to his house as a kid in Florida, ran through with Florida territory.
There you go.
He was, you know, Andre and Blackjack were big buddies. They were good pals. And, Barry got to be friendly with Andre, and he was just in awe of him since he was a kid. He was just in shock and awe. Now he gets to be his tag team partner. This guy is going to teach him the ways. Blackjack, maybe we do a little thing vignette where Blackjack, you know, tells Andre, take care of my son.
Five minutes, guys.
But then they're running up against my top, you know, two of my top heels, Roddy Piper and Tully Blanchard, to kind of have a loose association. And before the match, we get word that Roddy Piper's been, you know, having meetings with Andre, trying to get in his head a little bit. But Andre's not shaking here. Him and Barry pick up the win when Andre pins Tully. But seeds have been sown as Piper starts to kind of get into Andre's ear a little bit. In our main event for the world heavyweight title here, Jerry Lawler defending against Terry Funk, and the match ends in a wild disqualification. Referees, officials, everyone comes out. They brawl through the crowd. Place is going crazy. Sets up a rematch for show number two.
So nice.
Here's my first night of cards.
Okay, four matches. Only four matches, though.
Only four matches. But one of them's two out of three, though. One's two out of three.
So, Dan, which card? You got your $15 for your front row ticket, because remember, this is the 1980s. Which one are you buying?
You guys wouldn't hook me up? You wouldn't just let me come in and just watch
shows for free? Come on.
I probably would like JR's or JT or however you want to go. If you started with the tag team, just get me right away, hook me right away with the tags, and then kind of build up to the main event. I do like Will's card top to bottom. It's like guys I want to see every single match. There's nobody on Will's card that I don't want to just sit and watch. So I probably would have to use the bathroom before I came in. But I just imagine how crazy your atmosphere. I can imagine this is a very small venue, so like Terry Funk and Jerry Lawler like would literally tear the house down. So I'm rambling here, but I think I'll go with Will, but I do like some of the other things on Justin's card. I don't think I could go wrong, let's put it that way.
How much time do we have left, Dan?
You have 3 minutes.
Okay, JR, see if you can do this in a minute and a half, because I'm going to run down how I would book your card, okay?
Okay.
I have your guys. This is how I'm going, all right?
Yep.
Are you ready for this?
Go for it.
Okay. I have, as my main event, Nick Bockwinkel versus Terry Funk, two former champions, mm-hmm. two guys north of their peaks, and so they're going to be the guys that kind of spear this, right? I'm going to use Jerry Lawler in a heel role, okay? And I'm going to have him be the guy, because he has no problem doing this, using racial epithets and trying to coax Tito Santana out of his shell. And so I got Jerry Lawler versus Tito there, okay? I'm with you on the Rock and Roll versus Bulldogs. I'm putting Barry Windham and Tully Blanchard in a singles, though, as a technical type match, you know, plus they have like great chemistry from those Horsemen days. And then I'm going to put Andre versus Roddy Piper in like a crazy like brawl where basically Piper's just kind of hitting and running while Andre's just trying to get a hold of him. And once he gets a hold of him, he abuses and punishes Piper. But Piper is just one of the smartest guys in wrestling, so he avoids Andre through the match. And of course I had the Rock and Roll versus Bulldogs, so that's how I would book your card.
All right, Dan, what do I got for time here?
90 seconds.
All right, look at that, Will, right on the button. All right, I'm going Savage Steamboat on this card because I want to wow the fans that
perfect.
Are coming out for
yeah.
work rate. So, you know, two guys, whether they're both faces, both heels, however you want to use them, they're going out there and stealing the show to show what your promotion's all about. These are two guys that can go out there, 30 minutes, drop a vat, and have a fantastic match. Ted DiBiase tries to buy Sergeant Slaughter, tries to get him away from his American roots, and Slaughter says, hell no, I'm standing by my country. And he's here to defend the US of A against the evil Ted DiBiase. We have the Road Warriors Midnight Express. We'll keep them together. So that leaves me with Von Erich, Valentine, Murdoch, and Anderson. I think you could pair those guys up in any way. Let's go Murdoch in a face roll against Arn in a dirty old man.
That would be an awesome match.
Brawl. And then Kerry Von Erich Valentine maybe is the kind of the match before the main event. Just two veterans going at it, and Kerry gets the win. So that's how I go.
That's why I like my roster, man. You had that versatility, face, heel. And you know, realistically, Piper was a great baby face. You turned Piper baby. Terry Funk, face or heel. Lawler, face or heel. Nick Bockwinkel, when he turned face against Larry Zbysko, was a pretty good face. But you want to keep Bock as a heel for this time period.
And I think the key, too, is that for only having promotions with, you know, whatever, 14 guys, whatever it is with the tag teams, we have so much versatility, both of us, that you can have so many different matchups and feuds and angles without ever getting... I mean, we could run forever, probably, with these 14 guys each and never get tired of the matchups.
Easily.
But alas, guys, time is up.
All right, so that was a lot of fun, Will. So what we'll do is, in a few more episodes down the road, we'll hit up 86. We'll keep this base in place, and we're going to pick more guys that came into the picture in 1986. I think we'll maybe force us to drop a couple here just to not go crazy deep with the roster. So that'll be tricky, too. And then you can draft from there. So we'll talk more about that next time. But why don't we go ahead and take a quick break. We come back, we'll hit up fall number two.
Baby, if you give it to me, I'll give it to you. I know what you want. You know I got it, baby, if you give it to me.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net. Place of Nation, we are back, episode 2 of the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. Will and JT here, and we are ready for our second fall. So Dan McGinn, tee us up. What are we looking at here?
Guys, our second fall is Card Wars. Nothing but Card Wars. And today we are battling Clash of the Champions 1 versus Saturday Night's Main Event from April of 1988.
All right, Will. So we went back and forth a little bit. We talked about maybe doing the March Saturday Night's Main Event, which is the 15th edition, on March 12th. But we thought it would be a little more intriguing to do the Saturday Night's Main Event that was almost the answer to the first Clash. So Clash 1 took place March 27th, and Saturday Night's Main Event took place almost a month later, April 30th, 88, taped the week before in Springfield, Massachusetts, the 16th edition of Saturday Night's Main Event. And with Card Wars, the events, the exercises we're going to do on these, we're going to pick two cards that were close in tenure, or, you know, meant to be, I don't want to say rivals, but different things that we can compare against them. Now, that means it can be from rival promotions, or it can even be from different years within the same promotion. We may pick two SummerSlams to match up against each other. And we're going to break down the card, we're going to go through the matches, and then we're going to decide which card was better. Now, on the surface, I think the answer to this one is probably pretty easy. But we thought it'd be interesting anyway, because Saturday's main event is not really... I'm trying to think how to explain this well. Maybe you have a good explanation of it, too. I think it's a tough comparison in many ways to The Clash, because it's not really out to accomplish the same goals as The Clash. Do you agree with that?
I would. Also, the Saturday night's main event is on NBC. Right. This is a big deal. Whereas The Clash, it's nationwide, but it's, you know, still on TBS, which is still, I guess non-cable stations would carry it. I had cable at the time, so mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know the inner workings of how cable and you know, regular TV worked. I just know that I was able to see both of them, you know, when they happened, when they existed. So,
right. And I think maybe in my mind, the main difference is The Clash existed, you know, within the universe of the Jim Crockett Promotions. Storylines continued. If you watch things chronologically from, you know, Saturday Night and, Main Event and the other show Worldwide, and then you see The Clash, things progress. To me, the Saturday's main events are almost standalone installments in many ways. They're like showcases. Like you said, they're on NBC. They're there to try and hook in an audience that maybe isn't watching the promotion. So while the feuds are progressing and there are things that build Saturday's main events, to me, they're almost more of a showcase of the top stars of the month at this time.
Yeah, and there are exceptions to that rule, like you were saying, like you know, when they'd have a big angle, especially like with I think the two referees, right? The twin referees happened on a Saturday night's main event.
Yep. Am I wrong? It was on the main event, but yeah. Yep.
On the main event. Okay. But, you know, things like that. But I agree with you in general on that statement. But anyway, let's move on. Let's review these cards, buddy.
All right. Let's start with The Clash, since that chronologically happened first. Greensboro Coliseum, Greensboro, North Carolina, March 27th, 88. Tony Schiavone and Jim Ross are your announcers. So here's match number one. Will Jimmy Garvin versus Mike Rotunda for the NWA TV title in a collegiate rules match.
Man, these are two of my least favorite wrestlers at this time. And this was like watching paint dry for me. Because you only need a one count to get the win. You know, the crowd was hot for it, but that didn't last long because these guys could put anybody to sleep. It's just... You know, thankfully, Kevin Sullivan interfered in round two. Rotunda gets the win. It's over. We need to get out of this match. What did you think of it?
Agreed. Two guys. Rotunda is like, he's like that chick that you can't decide if you think she's hot or not. Like, you feel like she should be hot, but deep down you kind of know that you're not really attracted to her. And I feel like that's Mike Rotunda, right? So I feel like
the crazy thing is, I feel the same way about his son, Bray Wyatt, you know? I don't know if I like that guy or if I think his gimmick's hokey.
Maybe you just think you're supposed to like him. I feel like that's where we're at with Rotunda. Like, I feel like if you say you don't like Mike Rotunda, it's kind of like, well, why? I'm like, I don't know. Maybe I should like him. And then you look at him and you're like, no. and as a Dodea fanboy, IRS, all right, you know, pretty good gimmick in some pretty memorable storylines. But then I think back to some of his squashes or... You know, that freaking abdominal stretch and everything. It's like
an airplane spin finisher. He's a guy who's technically good, technically sound, and technically boring. There's no other way to put it. He can be technically good, but you're bored to tears watching it.
Right.
And Jimmy Garvin did really great in Texas. And then he teamed with Mr. Electricity, Steve Regal, in AWA. And he never got better. It just got progressively worse and worse. So I have nothing good to say. Actually, a bad start to Clash 1 with this match.
Well, things pick up a little bit here, Will, with the Midnight Express and the Fantastics, who are, of course, been in the news a little bit due to the passing of Tommy Rogers. For the NWA United States Tag Team Titles, match goes 10 minutes, 15 seconds. Disqualification, the Express win and retain their straps. Awesome match. If you've never seen it before, very highly regarded and one you need to go check out. Dusty finish aside, I think it was really a textbook match, and the crowd was just insane for this one.
You know, I've seen Midnight Express versus Fantastic matchups with the old Midnight Express with Dennis Condrey. I saw those matches in Texas. Really good matches in Texas between the Midnights and the Fantastics. I saw them in Mid-South. And now we're seeing the Stan Lane version of the Midnight Express against Fantastics. And this might be the best Fantastics Midnight Express matchup available from any of the companies that they fought in. The brawling, the out of control action. This, I don't know if you know this, but the Fantastics have a really hyped series with the Sheep Herders, you know, before they became the Bushwhackers.
Yep.
And it was all about how bloody and out of control they were. Unfortunately, their most famous match from the Crockett Cup 1986 has never been shown in full. But this match actually delivers that out of control action that I always wanted to see from the Sheep Herders feud. You know, both teams had great double teams. Tommy Rogers was excellent playing the face in peril. Cornette was the pest. You know what? Even with the screwy finish, we had the great post-match. The only thing missing from this match was the blood. Mm-hmm. Everything else was great about this match. Awesome, awesome match. And this probably is the best match of both shows. I'm just going to say it right now.
Yeah.
I don't know if you'd agree with that, but I think this is the best match from both shows.
I think there's only one that challenges it that we'll talk about. But it's a strong chance that it's the best match. And it's a very strong chance that, as we'll see, the Clash has the best two matches of the shows. All right, so match number three, the Road Warriors team with Dusty Rhodes versus the Powers of Pain and Ivan Koloff in a barbed wire match. And, of course, this was coming off when Animal got his face bashed in with the barbell. So he's wearing a mask or a helmet here. And going into this one, Will, I was pretty psyched because it kind of has all my essentials. Has some hosses, has a Russian, has a good stipulation. Of course, Dusty Rhodes. And it just ends up being a little disappointing. There's a little bit of violence, not really what you'd hope for. Animal's face guard is pretty cool. But just it never really kicked into that second gear. And it almost felt like what we talked about. I mean, it only goes, you know, 3.5 minutes. And it almost feels like what we talked about for what Saturday Night's Main Event was at this time, which was like a showcase. This felt the same. So it was like a little angle progression, but not a lot. To me, it just ended up being a little bit disappointing.
You know, and you see this in the 80s a lot, where you hear a stipulation that's on a card. Because if you look at like random stipulation matches from cards that tore, barbed wire Chicago street fight.
Mm-hmm.
Sign me up. Blood, guts, brawling, death, right? This is it. And then you watch it and you're underwhelmed and you're like, but this was the barbed wire Chicago street fight. Why am I underwhelmed? This match was a mess, man. Part of the problem is that the Powers of Pain at this time, they're not good wrestlers.
Mm-hmm.
The Road Warriors can be carried to a good match, but they're really not good wrestlers. Dusty Rhodes can have great matches, but watching Dusty Rhodes wrestle is more about the spectacle of Dusty Rhodes.
Right.
You know, and Ivan Koloff, bless his heart, great wrestler. You know, it's close to the end for Ivan Koloff.
Old as shit at this point.
old as shit. But he was having awesome matches in 85 and 86.
It's just, hey, you don't have to sell Russians on me.
It's time's catching up to Ivan. And so maybe the barbed wire Chicago street fight had the wrong participants in the match. But, man, this is a match where if you told me barbed wire Chicago street fight, I'm sold. I'm laying my money down.
Especially, I mean, because the feud behind it was so good. It's not even that it's just, you know, like you say, maybe the wrong guy. I think maybe the right guys were there because even the brawl when they bash Animal's eye was red hot.
That is true. That is true. The brawl after the match.
Well, yeah, but even hot. The one that set it up when they attacked them with the barbell and bashed them.
Yeah.
So that was good. But the brawl after is the better than the match. I mean, and
right.
It just ends up being. It just feels like it's cut short. It feels like this is a match they shouldn't have had here. Maybe they should have done like a singles or something to set it up down the road. Because it feels so shoved in the card, they don't have the time to really talk about it.
Right. Or you have a regular six-man tag here.
Right.
And then you set up the barbed wire Chicago street fight with more time on like the Great American Bash Tour.
Yes. That's exactly what should have happened. And the Powers of Pain ended up leaving because they didn't want to do the scaffold stuff. So maybe if you save this gimmick for later, maybe they stick around.
Yeah, because they wouldn't have to do those scaffold matches. Right. Who can blame them, you know? Anyway, so next match, what do we got?
All right, we got Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard taking on Lex Luger and Barry Windham, the NWA Tag Team titles on the line. And Luger and Windham do win those titles when Luger pinned Anderson after whipping him into a chair that J.J. Dillon was holding just under 10 minutes. This is a match I really liked quite a bit. Luger and Windham in the underdog, not underdog, but in the babyface role against the Horsemen. You can never go wrong with that. We talked a lot about Windham a minute ago in our draft. I really like this. I like the heat segment on Windham that really built as the crowd got into it. And then the, you know, another textbook tag match, just like our earlier one that was worked to near perfection, never really slowed down, told a good story, and kept that manic pace that Arn and Tully are so good at. My PIC Scott Criscolo always talks about how they're the masters of controlled mayhem. You know, like everything's going crazy around them, but somehow they're always in control. And there was a lot of that towards the end of this match.
No, you're right. And this is a match I've seen dozens of times. It's still one of the hottest matches of the 80s, tag matches. Did you notice, and I don't know if you did, because when I was a kid, when Tully hit that slingshot suplex, it was over, right?
Yes.
It was over. And then when that didn't get the pin, I was legitimately shocked. And I knew the outcome of the match. But I was like, oh, wow, he didn't get the pin off the slingshot suplex. So as a kid watching that, I was really shocked. And then revisiting the match 25 years later, it's like, oh, wow, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I forgot that he kicked out of that. And it shocked me again because I'm just used to that being the game ender. And, man, you're right. When Luger got that hot tag, it meant something.
Mm-hmm.
This is the former Horseman / Horseman associate getting his revenge. And this led nicely to a future match where Barry Windham turns on his partner Lex Luger, which
yes.
We can debate if that made sense or not. But is this the other match that you would say is the contender for the best match on either show?
Yes.
20 minutes, guys. 20 minutes.
Thanks, Dan. Yes, which is funny because I think many think maybe the main event would be that. We'll get to that in a second. But I like
this. We'll talk about the main event, yeah.
This and the other tag match were my two favorites of all the cards.
No, absolutely. And I agree with that. And there's a reason why we had Barry Windham, Arn Anderson, and Tully Blanchard drafted in our draft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one's going to pick Luger in 1986. Might pick him in 1987 or 1988. No one's going to pick Luger in 1985 for sure. But those other three, Barry Windham, Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, in 1988, three of the best wrestlers, hands down. Hands down. All right, let's move to the main event.
All right, so main event, Sting versus Ric Flair for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. Sting had interrupted Ric Flair's celebration, issued a challenge to the champion. J.J. Dillon threw champagne in his face. Sting hit J.J. with a Stinger Splash, put him in the deathlock, and Flair accepted the challenge. And then Sting beat Flair by DQ on Pro, and the rematch was set up here. We go 45 minutes, we go to a draw, and Flair retains on a judge's decision, which a finish I'm still not that crazy about when I was rewatching it.
Talk about the judges.
The judges, let me pull it up here.
There's only two that matter, man.
Right. Well, the guy who played Eddie Haskell, you mean?
No, man. Jason Hervey.
Yes, Jason Hervey.
And who's he sitting next to?
It is, why am I drawing a blank? Help me
Missy
out.
Hyatt.
Missy
man.
Hyatt, that's right.
Your future wife.
That's where it started. That's where the romance started. So it's him, her, and Eddie Haskell? Those are the three?
I don't even know if that's it. I just know that Hervey and Hyatt were sitting together, and I forgot. Oh, wow, that's right.
Actually, here are the judges. We're Sandy Scott, Gary Juster, and Jason Hervey. Patty Mullen, the former Penthouse Pet of the Month, and Ken Osmond, who played Eddie Haskell.
Wow.
To Beaver.
Penthouse Pet of the Month, okay.
So
you would never see that on a Saturday night's main event, that's for sure.
No, and the judges' decisions were as follows. Patty Mullen awarded it to Ric Flair. Gary Juster chose Sting. Sandy Scott said it was a draw, and we were not privy to Wayne and Eddie's picks. So the match was a draw.
I think Osmond was there because they had done the new Leave It to Beaver show
yes.
on TBS, and I guess he was promoting that. Hey, I watched it. I watched the old Leave It to Beaver, so I watched the new one too. What can I say? Sorry.
The old SOB.
Sting versus Ric Flair.
Sting versus Ric Flair. So what are your thoughts on the match?
Here's the thing, man. I've seen this match several times. They always include it like on the Ric Flair DVDs mm-hmm. or Best of DVDs. Because, you know, this is the match that made Sting. You know, and I get that. I get that. Historically, this is the match that proved that Sting could go with the champion, right? Because they had had TV matches before this, earlier in the year. But if you're talking about great matches, this is a match that you'd want to put on a main event. You know, this is Ric Flair walking somebody through steps. But look, the weaknesses are still there. Too many repeat spots. Too long for Sting, for him not to repeat the spots. You know, everybody always says if this match was 20 minutes, mm-hmm. if this was a 20-minute match, this could have been Sting's best match of all time.
Yep.
It really did go too long, man. And then that's a drawback, but, you know, I understand what they were trying to prove. Sting at the time wasn't the right guy to go 45 minutes and keep it interesting for 45 minutes the way that a Ricky Steamboat could. Or, you know, Terry Funk and Ric Flair didn't have any 40-minute matches, but they could have because it's freaking Terry Funk.
And the one thing I like...
Or maybe a Nick Bockwinkel versus Ric Flair could have easily gone 45 in their sleep.
And I think you're right that they're just trying to show that Sting was on that level, but I agree with you. I just don't think he was yet.
I don't know. Have you ever seen the hour-long draw between Nick Bockwinkel and Kurt Hennig from AWA?
Once a while ago. It's probably one I got to revisit.
You really need to revisit. Yeah. Maybe me and you, maybe we need to sync up on that.
Okay.
But that's a match that builds where and it's babyface versus babyface, where it builds and builds and builds. The first part is kind of like Bockwinkel showing the young Hennig how to wrestle. Then the second part is Hennig getting testy and showing some heel flares. And the third part is like this bloody, nasty brawl. And so they broke the match up to where it kind of built to one of the best matches of all time. Really. And I don't say that with hyperbole. Sting versus Flair did not do that. And that's the biggest disappointment, is that Ric Flair is a smart wrestler, but he couldn't build the match to kind of highlight Sting as an elite wrestler.
The one thing I did like was at the end, they didn't do the hackney-eyed, is that how you say it? Hackney-eyed? Hackensacked? Hackney-eyed finish where, you know, the guy goes for the pin with 2 seconds left. That's one of those things that just always drives me nuts, where you can see them kind of stalling and then quickly go for a pin attempt with 2 seconds left.
Right.
What they did here felt a little bit more organic, where Sting put the Scorpion on with about a little over a minute or so left, and Flair is cognizant of the time, and he's trying to hang on. And to me, that's a better story than the guy had him beat but gets saved by the bell.
Absolutely. 15 minutes.
It's almost like the finish of the Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, Iron Man before it went into overtime, right?
Right, yes.
Yep, Sean's holding on to this. Yeah, I'm fine with that finish.
I like that much better than the, you know, Sting gets a flurry and starts getting pin attempts. I like this where Flair's aware of the time and he's doing whatever he can to hang on over the last minute.
Yeah, I don't like that they went to the judges, though. You know?
No, me neither. I just go to the draw, you know.
Yeah. All right, well, easily a thumbs-up show.
Mm-hmm.
Even with Sting Flair's... weaknesses.
Still a good match.
Yes. Still a good match. Yep. Still worthy of putting out there to show that Sting is the young blood and Flair is the legend. And they have a good match. Just you wish it was a classic match.
And I mean, I think you could argue it's probably the third best match of the two cards.
That's easily.
Yeah, you know, because the deficiencies we mentioned are only due to the hype. And nothing to do with the quality of the match and ways.
Exactly.
Expectations.
Exactly.
So, all right, let's head to Springfield for the signings main event 16. This is right after WrestleMania 4, about a month later. Jim Duggan opens things up by defeating Hercules in a singles match, 8:47. And this was really a way to kickstart the Andre the Giant feud, because Duggan, in his little pre-match promo, talks about how Andre cost him at WrestleMania, cost him a chance at the title, and he's looking for revenge. So Hercules kind of used here as a pawn for Heenan, and it's about what you'd expect for a Jim Duggan versus Hercules match in 1988.
But you know what? It was an okay match.
Yeah, they worked hard.
They worked hard. They told the story with Andre and Heenan interfering, and you know Heenan had to save Hercules for the DQ. You know, at the end, mm-hmm. So this was fun. Like, I like this as an opener better than Rotunda versus Garvin.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay. So, but it didn't go very long, but nothing really negative to say about this match. Right. Not a horrible performance from Hercules. Perfectly fine match.
And actually the longest match of this card at 8:47.
Yeah, but not the best match on this card. But yeah.
No. Up next was Bruce Beefcake and Danny Davis. 3:10, Beefcake gets the win, and this was, of course, continuing the Beefcake, Jimmy Hart, Honky Tonk Man feud. Jimmy comes out with a pair of shears, and he's got a little artiste hat on, and Beefcake gives Danny Davis a cut after the match.
And puts on the hairspray. Remember
yes, that's
that,
right.
That, like, colored hairspray? And I was always disappointed as a kid with the barber, because it never really seemed like he really gave them funky haircuts.
Mm.
Do you remember the new breed from Crockett?
Yes.
Remember how they'd have these crazy hairdos because they were from the future? I always wanted Beefcake to do that. Plus, Danny Davis was so hated back then.
Yes.
People don't realize how much he was hated. He was a genuinely good heel.
Although we're starting to kind of reach the end of it here. It's
yeah.
more 87 where he was super.
Yeah, I know, but yeah. Still, man, that would have been great if, like, they would have had a streak going right through the middle of his hair and then put the spray on, you know? It's more like spraying, but yeah, I digress.
Right, spray painted a B on his chest and then his hair.
Yeah, it was garbage, but it was fun garbage. So that's how I liken the match.
One thing we didn't mention, the opener, Ultimate Warrior came out to save Duggan, so that was kind of a... You know,
to
get Warrior over there.
Oh, yay.
All right, match number 3. Our WWF World Champion Randy Savage pinned One Man Gang in 6 minutes with the flying elbow smash. Slick accidentally hit the gang with his cane, and then prior to the bout, Savage has scared Slick backstage. Of course, this is a rematch from WrestleMania 4. They showed the highlight of that, where Gang lost by DQ in the semifinals for attacking Savage with the cane. So Savage in... Was this... I guess it's the second... televised defense because he defended was he champion yet in the last one? No, he wasn't. So this is his first big title defense on TV. What did you think of this one? Worthy of a Savage title match?
Oh, I liked it. I thought it was great. I thought the idea of Savage using his speed and going to the top to gain the advantage on Gang. And Gang, if you notice, Gang bumped big in this match. You know, I love the Savage using the One Man Gang's beard for that, like, throat
yes.
choke over the rope, and then Gang bumped a huge for that. And then there was that huge bump where Savage clothesline Gang over the top rope, and that mm-hmm. was a really nasty bump from Gang. So Gang was moving in this.
He was.
And I liked the fact that once he was able to actually get a hold of Savage, he could punish Savage because he's a bigger guy, and, you know, dropping that big elbow drop. And I really enjoyed this match. For a 6-minute match, this was pretty much all action and a fun matchup.
Like, so is this your yep, go ahead, Dan.
10 minutes, guys. 10 minutes.
So is this your match of the card here?
Oh, without a doubt. Even with the Slick interference, it worked.
Right.
Because Slick cost Gang the match. Whereas, you know, the Kang caused the DQ at WrestleMania. Here, Slick hits Gang with the cane. Savage goes up, hits that big top rope elbow, which is one of my favorite moves,
mm-hmm.
one of my favorite finishers, when it's done by Savage, not by HBK. And I thought this was the highlight of the show. Nothing else even came close, as we're going to talk about when we talk about the next two matches.
And so this right now would probably both clock in as our fourth best match between the two shows.
Do you agree? Was there anything, I mean, did you enjoy watching this?
Yeah, no, I think you covered it. Yeah, you know, I thought they showed a little bit at Mania, but they couldn't really get into the groove because Savage had to kind of keep his energy for the main event, and they didn't want Gang to get too much on him. And that finish at WrestleMania always bugged me because it makes the Gang right. look so stupid,
yeah.
like you mentioned, with him. I mean, why you're that close to a world title, vacant world title match, why you try to bash this guy with a cane after you've, you know, owned him for the whole match? So that always bugs me. And so I thought this finish was much better, and they really atoned for what was disappointing at Mania.
I would not have been opposed to an extended Macho Man One Man Gang series at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that could have run on the house shows to keep from burning out Savage DiBiase throughout 88.
No, I agree. And so let's go to our next match.
All right, tag title match, Demolition, the tag team champions. They had just won the belts at WrestleMania from Strikeforce, and they battle the British Bulldogs. They win by DQ in a non-title match around 5 minutes. Smith and Dynamite return ringside after chasing Fuji backstage and attack the champs with the broken pieces of Fuji's cane. The Bulldogs, like we mentioned during our previous fall, they had by this point really kind of become a shell of themselves thanks to Dynamite's injuries. Here we are in early 88, and he was really just kind of on his last legs as far as a major promotion goes. They'd stick around till the end of the year, but really this is probably one of their last big matches, I think.
Yeah, and it was garbage.
Yeah. This is like the version of the barbed wire match from The Clash, in that looking at it on paper, you think that this could maybe be a sort of show stealer, and it ends up being very disappointing.
Well, let me give you a little background. I hate Barry Darso. I think he's one of the worst wrestlers I've ever seen. And when we do our next Dangerous Five, what do we call it? The Dangerous Five? Last show on show one?
Dan? Yeah, I think it was the Dangerous Five, yeah.
Right? Isn't it the Dangerous Five?
Yes, Dangerous
when
Five.
When we do our next Dangerous Five on our five least liked wrestlers,
okay.
Barry Darso is number one with a bullet. He might be number two, but we'll talk about number one in a second. If they might flip. I don't know yet. I think he's a hack wrestler. I can't believe he had such a long career. He did one smart thing in this match, and that was holding Dynamite Kid's legs so Dynamite couldn't get the tag. You know, like when he fell, he hooked his legs. That was it. But these guys are stupid. So let's see. Dynamite struggles to get the hot tag. Bulldog or Smith comes in, clears the ring, and tags Dynamite back in.
Ugh,
stupid.
I hate that when they do that tag match. It makes no sense.
But Darso was getting his ass beat, and he did the same thing. Tags in Edie. Edie comes in for a cup of coffee. Not even a cup. Maybe just a sniff of the cup of coffee. And tags Darso back in. Then the Bulldogs chase Fuji back, get the broken cane, come in for the DQ. What a stupid match.
Yep.
And we should mention, this was when WWF was in full force using the animal mascots, because Matilda was there leading the Bulldogs. It's just, this is garbage. I hate Demolition.
And it was non-title, so not a ton of intrigue. I guess you think maybe non-titles, I mean, the Bulldogs may steal the win to get a title shot down the line. And, you know, if my memory's right, and I don't know, Dan, maybe you can correct this, there were not that many title changes in Saturday's Main Event's history. And I think that's where another comparison to The Clash comes in, whereas, again, Saturday's Main Event was almost more on the level, in some ways, of a syndicated show with more marquee matchups. But I don't think there's more than one or two title changes in the run, the initial run of the show. I know Demolition and the Brainbusters is one. Were there any other ones? I can't think of any off the top of my head.
I have no idea.
There was the Fake Out, the Demolition, or sorry, the Heart Foundation Rockers one, where the rope broke. That was Saturday Night's Main Event.
And that doesn't count in canon, does it?
Nope, it does not. So I think when Demolition, Dan, you know, when Demolition won it back for the Brainbusters, was that Saturday Night's Main Event as well? I don't know if you know off the top of your head.
Is that the 2 out of 3 falls?
I think that's when they lost it to them. They lost it in July 89 was the 2 out of 3 falls. The Busters won it. That was the July 89 Saturday Night's Main Event. No, I don't think Demolition won it back on one.
I feel like they did on like a random Superstars, but
yeah,
I could be wrong.
So that may be the only title change recognized from the initial run of Saturday Night's Main Event.
Right.
I mean, the main event had the Hogan Andre, obviously, but anyway,
now,
before we go.
Now I have to go back and look at all the clashes to see how many title change happened there, because off the top of my head, I can't remember a lot of title change. I don't know. I mean, that's something I've never bothered to look at, you know? So now that's going to either be something that one of our smart listeners points out to us, you know, one of our historians, or something that we're going to have to research for show number 3.
Yeah, the one I can think of off the top of my head was Austin Steamboat one. Was that The Clash where they had the title change? I thought it was.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. But they had so many matches. I mean, they had pay-per-view matches too. I don't know.
All right, fellas, you have 3 minutes, first and foremost. But I was correct. Demolition did defeat the Brainbusters on the November 4th edition of Superstars, and it was recorded on October 2nd.
Okay,
well, let's get to these last two matches. John Morocco versus the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. First off, Morocco comes with Superstar Billy Graham to the ring. Ugh. I have no idea what he was doing there. I don't remember him being there, but it was garbage because my other least favorite wrestler of all time, Don Morocco, lazy, useless, worthless, horrible offense. Did you see where he almost paralyzed DiBiase with that horrible power slam?
Yes, and Stephen Graham is stabbing his Will Voodoo doll right now. But
I don't care what that Canadian thinks. I really
Nobody
don't.
Nobody does. That's the beauty of it.
Oh, man. Poor Stephen. But then after fighting back, Morocco gives DiBiase one of the worst Russian leg sweeps I have ever seen. Yeah. Just pure garbage. And to top it off, DiBiase wins with a freaking body slam. But Morocco had his foot under the rope. Just garbage. Do you agree this was garbage and that Morocco sucks?
Especially by this point. I mean, it's really, really bad Morocco by this point in 88.
Bloated, gassed to the gills, doesn't belong in a ring. That's all I got to say. Let's move on
another,
to the last match.
And just quick, another Mania rematch. So the one thing I will give, I do like about the show, I guess we can talk about this match quick and then we'll talk about that. Rick Rude defeats Coco Beware 3:44. I think this was just a match to continue Rude's push up the ladder.
Yeah, and it could have been. It was a fun match because Coco could work, Rude could work. They could have had a great match if given time. I really wish this would have been like 1984 Memphis when both guys were really good in Memphis.
In a rarity too, if you look through the canon of Saturday's Main Events, they're usually 4 to 5 matches, and here you get 6, which is a lot for Saturday's Main Event. And it felt you could feel it with the short length. So maybe we'd be better off if they had just dumped that DiBiase match and gave Rude and Coco a little bit more time, and then the tag title a little bit more time.
Right. Or just made Savage One Man Gang and Rude, Coco, and Doug and Hercules your 3-man card. That would have been great for me. That would have been wrestling heaven for me. Now, if we were to combine these two cards together, what would you put from both cards, JR?
So how many matches are we talking?
We do 5 or 6. Your choice.
Okay, well, the Clash had 5, and this had 6. So let's go with 5. 5 matches. I'm going with Midnight Express Fantastics, no doubt there. I'm going with Luger and Wyndham versus Tully and Arn. Flair Sting is my main event. Savage One Man Gang. And I looked at probably Doug and Hercules, I think. That was a good opener. The crowd was into it, and it pushes along the Doug and Andre feud, which is a big one for them.
The only thing I would have done different, though, is I would have made Midnight's Fantastics my opener.
Yep.
Okay? Just to get that classic match opener. I would have followed it with Duggan versus Hercules. Then I would have done the tag match with Luger and Wyndham versus Arn Tully. Then I would have had Savage and Gang lead into Sting Flair.
I agree with that order. So I was just picking the 5. I wasn't giving my order before.
No, great. And I think that would have been the best card that these two companies could have possibly had from what they gave us. And Rick Rude versus Coco Beware could have been great. Could have been great, you know, but it wasn't. So
the one thing I liked about Saturday's Main Event on this one here is that they really played up, it almost filled the role of, like, you know, Backlash or Extreme Rules nowadays, where it really was a lot of spillover from WrestleMania 4. So we have one pure rematch,
yeah,
DiBiase Morocco.
I agree.
And, well, Savage Gang as well. But Duggan plays up the stuff with Andre that came out of 4. Beefcake Davis is still an offshoot of the Beefcake Conky match that had happened there. Demolition Bulldogs is really kind of the standalone. And then,
well, you could have had Demolition versus Strikeforce there, right? Wasn't that the tag match at 4?
Yeah, and they weren't. Martel wasn't hurt yet, right? That happens later when they hit him with the. That might have already been filmed, I forget. But remember, Martel gets hurt, okay, the decapitation device on the floor, or they hit him with the cane, or whatever the heck happened, and he ends up being out till 89. But.
Okay, I don't remember that, but yeah, that you got to remember, this is around the time that I started finding girls and not finding...
girls in cars.
Yeah, yeah, this is my coming of age here, and wrestling was not part of that equation. had to go revisit it, you know,
well,
all
guys,
these years later.
Time is up, although as much as I'd love to hear about Will discovering girls, we should probably move on.
taped May 10th in Duluth, Minnesota, aired June 11th, was when Martel got hurt. Demolition, hang on, I'm wrong on that. Yeah, I don't know. It looked like it was around that time. They interfered and made the save, so it might have been a prime time or something, but...
Nice.
Anyway, all right, that's it for that fall, so what's your winner, Will, overall? I'd say, obviously, the Clash takes this one.
Easily, not even close. I mean, even the matches that were good on Saturday Night's Main Event were fun. They weren't great.
So there you go. Let's take a break. We'll come back with fall number 3. Girls in cars. I love girls in cars.
Girls in cars. Place to Be Nation and Pro Wrestling Only are proud to present the PWO PTBN Podcast Network. Join us for a variety of great shows that explore all the facets of professional wrestling.
Join good old Will from Texas for our Place to Be Nation reaction shows, and Goodwill Wrestling, which has been kicking since before JR had barbecue sauce.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play and join Chad and Parv as they discuss classic NWA and WCW pay-per-view.
And take in one of our newest podcasts, Exile on Bed Street, and allow Chris Zellner to give you a history lesson about important moments in wrestling's colorful past.
Listen to Johnny, Pete, Parv, and Kelly, the titans of wrestling, as they examine in depth the history of the WWF in the 1970s and 1980s.
And then there's Brainbuster, the wrestling game show, tag teams back again, the Pro Wrestling Super Show, the All Japan Excite Series, and the Super Extreme Vault for some ECW.
You can hear all of these great podcasts and more on one feed. Remember, PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network, part of the Place to Be Nation family.
Place to Be Nation, we are back. Episode 3 of the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. Two falls are in the books, and Will, we are here into fall number 3. And so far, by the way, no F-bombs from either of us, so the Get the F Out swear jar is empty. Still a nothing-nothing tie here as we move forward through the future to see who will buy who. A month of WWE Network. But Dan, we turn things to you. What is our third fall?
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book.
Your third fall, gentlemen, is called This Week in History, and it's only appropriate we do the week of June the 7th through the 13th, the important happenings in wrestling, the big-time cards, anything you guys want to talk about, it's all yours. All
right, so we'll throw a little sponsorship Graham Coffin's way, thehistoryofwwe.com, of course. You can listen to the History of WWE podcast, Wrestling with Optimism podcast here at Place to Be Nation, and Graham's site was used to provide us this information that Dan was kind enough to pull together, and Will did some research, as did I. So, Will, what I thought we'd do, we have some information in front of us. We'll kind of just skim through a little bit, talk about some of the big happenings on this week in history. There were some big shows. There were some big moments. There were some big title changes, some big backstage happenings. So why don't you, kick things off, pick one of the ones that you discovered, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. The one I want to start off with, and I don't know if I've ever seen footage of this because it happened at a house show in St. Louis on June 10th, 1983. Harley Race defeats Ric Flair for the NWA world title.
Pretty big one to start with, 1983.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing because Harley Race and Ric Flair have had some great matches, okay, in their feud. And I'm curious to see how this match turned out. And I'm guessing St. Louis is hot for Harley Race. Ric Flair is a big draw in St. Louis. And this leads up to the first Starrcade match. Because remember, the first Starrcade, Ric Flair actually defeated Harley Race to win the belt. And it felt like this truly coming-of-age moment, this passing of the torch. But Ric Flair by that time was a multi-time world champion. But that felt like the passing of the torch. And that's historically how it's played up. But the title change that preceded it wasn't even taped. It's on a house show in St. Louis.
Right.
So, I don't know. Have you ever seen any of those old Harley Race Ric Flair matches?
No.
Besides the Starrcade match?
No, Starrcade's the only one I've seen.
Okay. Well, you're really missing out because the Starrcade match is not their best match. Plus, I always forget who the guest referee is.
Kaniski, and he's awful.
Kaniski, and it is awful in that match. It had the fluky ending to it, but man, these guys had a great feud. There was a point in the feud where Harley Race puts a bounty out on Ric Flair's head, and that made for great television. And two of Ric Flair's friends at that time, Ricky Steamboat, one of his greatest rivals, and Wahoo McDaniel against like Bob Orton Jr., Dick Slater, and all these other guys trying to collect that bounty from Harley Race. And so, very memorable night, but ironically not, it's an NWA title change, and at that point in time those are always important, but not one that I've ever seen or seen footage pop up for.
So here's something that happened in 85 across three shows, and these are really just quick points, then I'm going to bring up something a little bit bigger. So in 1985, on June 9th in Japan, Antonio Inoki, Tatsumi Fujinami, and Kenji Kimura defeated Hulk Hogan, Adrian Adonis, and Dick Murdoch in a six-man tag. 4 days later, Inoki defeated Hogan by countout in 11 minutes with the IWGP's title on the line. So have you ever seen those matches?
I don't know if I've seen those specific matches. If they were available and taped on New Japan, I'm sure I have. But I have seen all of those guys work in Japan. Fujinami, for those who don't know, one of the greatest wrestlers of the 80s. Right there with Flair, right there with Lawler, right there with Savage. One of the greatest wrestlers in the 1980s. Number one contender for best wrestler of the 80s. Okay. Inoki is a wrestler who you could watch and say, man, he's part of some great matches. But trust me, myself and my my buddy Childs Walker and my friend Chris Zellner, who has the Exile on Bad Street show here on Place to Be Nation, we watched a lot of New Japan, and Inoki is also one of the worst wrestlers of all time. He could be in some of the best matches or the worst matches. And it's true, when they say Hogan goes to Japan to work, Hogan could work in Japan. He was really fun to watch. And actually, a lot of his earlier WWF title defenses in 84 and 85, he actually put those working boots on. I just think after years and years of being on the road night in, night out, I think he had to find a formula that was easier on his body. Unfortunately, it's a little hokier, and he didn't have the great matches that he was able to have earlier in his run. And Dirt Murdoch and Adonis, I love them as a tag team. Other people don't like them. I thought they were great as the North-South connection. And so that's all I got to say about that. I don't know if I've seen those specific matches, but I have seen the famous Hogan-Inoki match where Hogan knocks Inoki out. But I don't think that's this match. I think that's earlier.
So also in that week in 85 was the first ever show at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. So just wanted to note that. So a couple big things in later years that happened in this week, besides two King of the Ring events, 1993 and 1997, we had the ring collapse on SmackDown. If you remember that, Brock Lesnar in the Big Show hits him with the superplex and the ring falls apart. And still a really fun kind of holy shit moment that happened on SmackDown. To see those two big guys execute that move, the ring bounce up and down with the referee and then just shatters and falls to the mat, or falls to the floor, rather. I always thought that was a really cool moment.
Yeah. You know, did you ever see the Mark Henry Big Show match from Vengeance 2011?
Yes.
The one where they did the same thing where the ring goes. I was actually there live for that. And the only reason I mentioned that is when you're there live and you see the ring collapse, it really is a holy shit moment. It really feels that way. It felt really exciting to be part of, like you were witnessing a spectacle. And so I imagine that being there on that SmackDown tape, it was the same thing. You're witnessing the spectacle where this ring just collapses. And you weren't expecting it.
And it always stood out to me during a time when, you know, the brand extension was going strong as such a SmackDown moment. Like, I think it was one of those first moments that helped SmackDown gain an identity of, because all the big moments always happen on Raw. You know, big things happen on Raw besides, you know, SmackDown 6 and stuff. But I'm talking angles and moments. And that was like a big one that finally happened on SmackDown. And it kind of helped build their identity a bit as Brock Lesnar was starting his reign.
Sure. And Lesnar, I mean, we don't look at Lesnar as like being as big as the Big Show, right? But right. Man, if you're close to that guy's huge. Mm-hmm. He's just huge. Like if you've ever had a chance to sit close to a ring when he's out there, he TV doesn't do justice to how big that guy is. And the Big Show too. I've been 3 feet away from Big Show. The guy is a monster, you know, so you get overwhelmed by seeing how big these guys are. So when you see it, you can absolutely believe that that ring would collapse with those guys in it.
Without a doubt. And if we go 4 years earlier to a time where most people probably wanted the ring to collapse, and that was the reveal of the higher power is Vince McMahon. If you remember, this was pushed back a couple weeks due to the passing of Owen Hart over the Edge, so this gets bumped a bit. And it turns out that Vince McMahon was the man behind The Undertaker screwing up with Vince McMahon, screwing over Vince McMahon. It was very confusing, the whole thing. And it really, anybody else in that role probably would have made more sense than Vince McMahon. Anyone they could have dug out. There were tons of rumors at the time from Jake Roberts, yep, Ted DiBiase. Lots of rumors abounding over who was controlling The Undertaker. It ends up just being Vince. You know, we get the great moment of the reveal, which is still fun, where he, you know, pulls the hood off. It was me all along. But when you actually think about it, just a real waste of a lot of build. And face Vince in early 99 was actually kind of fun, feuding with heel Shane, who had taken over the ministry and was going up against his dad and the corporation. And I liked that little dynamic. I thought Shane as the lead heel dog was fun, kind of forcing out his old man dad. And then they just kind of stick them back together.
I hated it.
Yeah, just, and then that same night was, of course, when they revealed that Austin had become co-owner or whatever. That was coming right out of the higher power. So,
just as dumb. Stupid Russo TV. Just garbage. Little known fact, I had actually stopped watching wrestling, period, in 1999. I'd been a big fan during the Monday Night Wars. Got me back into wrestling. I loved wrestling. But I thought that the product that WCW and WWF were presenting was so stupid that I couldn't take it anymore. Even if there was an outside chance that you would get a great match here or there, I was done with it. I couldn't watch the product. The only thing that kept me a wrestling fan was finding the internet and this online world of wrestling fans. That was it. I was done because I thought Russo booking and WWF was stupid. And this was at the peak of wrestling's popularity.
Mm-hmm.
WCW had lost me in 1998. And it just, you know, I was a WCW guy, man. I backed the NWO, Goldberg, DDP, all of that. I was a fan of all of it. But the booking was so horrible. And nothing positive ever happened on that show. It just drained my fandom. And I wasn't the only one. There were tons of guys I watched wrestling with that just stopped watching. And the only reason I stayed a wrestling fan was because I discovered people online talking about wrestling. And then I started discovering the older wrestling. And then when Russo left WWF for WCW, WWF's product almost instantaneously, maybe took a few months, improved to where I started watching WWF again, and I never watched WCW on a regular basis up until the end. So
20 minutes, fellas, 20 minutes.
Just a horrible, horrible time for Will to be a wrestling fan. 1999. I don't know. Were you knee deep into wrestling at the time? Like, were you sold? Were you all in, JR?
Yeah. You know, and I know I don't want to get too much into the age stuff on the show. I think it was just a different time period in my life, and the difference was I was, you know, a sophomore in college, freshman in a sophomore year in 99. And so and to have wrestling finally be, after slogging through so many years of, you know, not something you can talk about and not something a lot of people were watching, to all of a sudden be in college and everyone's freaking talking about wrestling and Raw and Nitro, and, you know, I'm on the internet and there's all these great websites I'm reading stuff about, and I had friends, we'd watch Raw together and, you know, tape Nitro and then watch Nitro together. And it was such a fun time to be a fan at that age after years of having to just, you know, have four people to talk about it with was enough for me to stay into it. And again, I think the age thing just comes into a little bit of play in that, you know, when you're 19, you're in college, you're going to parties, you know, Stone Cold's out there tossing beers around, The Rock's being an asshole, you know, like all that stuff. I think just spoke maybe a little bit better to where I was. Now I'm
well, hold objective. On. I was still in my early 20s now.
Yeah, but you know, you're old 20. You know, you're old 20s.
Well, you know, but
you weren't in that kind of community, were you? You know what I mean? At that time?
Yes. Yeah. Well, we'll put it this way: 1997, 98. I used to work at a nightclub, right?
Yeah, we're talking about 99, right?
Oh, right. But let me give you the background.
Okay.
So from 96 through 98, the entire nightclub was watching wrestling on Monday nights. Cause Mondays and Tuesdays were our weekends. So Monday night viewing parties were like our Saturday night, you know, where you could go drink some beer and watch wrestling. And then you go out to a club or a bar afterwards. And at that time, we did that all the way through 98. But man, after Goldberg lost his title, after The Rock screwing over Austin at Survivor Series 98, just people got fed up with the constant swerves, the constant getting over by the heels. Just it just lost its momentum. To me, that wasn't even an age thing. It was just a logic thing. But you're absolutely right, though, that you could talk about wrestling. You can go to a bar or club with an NWO shirt, no one blink an eye.
And I think part of it, too, maybe just a little bit of the difference besides the age thing, is you mentioned that you were out of wrestling, got back in time for the Attitude Era.
For me, I
missed the big rock and wrestling era in the 80s, because I didn't really start watching until 1990. So I missed that era where it was like that before, right? So I hadn't lived this time period. And my main, you know, growing as a fan, 92, 93, 94, 95, 96, very canned programs from both promotions. A lot of people talking about it. So to finally, when 97 came around, to finally have some excitement breathing into the product. And now we're at this point where I still only have those handful of people to talk to it about, but at least every week is really exciting, which we didn't have.
That's a fair point.
Right. So then we get to 98 and it's continuing, it's building. And now we're starting to get that mainstream. And then I get to a different place, this place I haven't been before in college. And to have it be, you know, I can hang a Stone Cold poster in my room, in my dorm, and it's not, you know, nowadays you do it and it's looked at as like nostalgia and it's cute. But at that point, you know, 2 years, even 2 years before, you hold, you know, you hang up a Shawn Michaels poster in your room and you're going to get laughed out of the freaking dorm, right? Well,
as you should, but yeah.
But you know what I'm saying. So, I mean, it wouldn't have been as acceptable as having a Stone Cold Steve Austin poster in your room, which was saw as like a really cool thing. And I mean, even non-fans were watching. I mean, I had one roommate that didn't care and even he got into it, you know, in 2000-ish. So I think just almost that feeling of I earned this by sitting through, and to me, the nostalgic,
all
but
those bad years,
through
yeah.
all those years of, you know, me in my living room with my dad sleeping in the recliner watching pay-per-views with only one person to talk about after when I call my friend Jim, to all of a sudden get to this point where you can't even walk from room to room without being able to talk about, you know, WrestleMania or, you know, whatever happened.
You know what got me back into watching pay-per-views on a monthly basis? This is so bad. My wife, she was my girlfriend at the time. Her family had the little black box.
Yes. Yep.
And so my wife, she had to work on Mondays. I didn't, you know. And so I would go over Sunday nights. Her whole family would be asleep, and I'd get to watch the pay-per-views on the little black box for the next 2 years.
15 minutes, guys.
You know, I was locked in, man, from 2000 all the way till 2002. I was locked in on WWF pay-per-views, man.
The black box was just a godsend. My friend that I mentioned a minute ago, Jim, had one as early as like 1991. So I watched a bunch of pay-per-views with him, and even if I didn't watch them with him, he would record them and I was able to get them quickly. And actually my grandparents had a black box back in that time frame as well. So I remember going over with my cousin and watch even some WCW shows. Bash of the Beach 94, I remember watching over at my grandparents' house and a few others. So black boxes definitely, I think, were probably the entry point for a lot of fans. And if I didn't, and it was one I didn't order. I mean, did you used to watch the Scramble Vision? I watched them all the time. Many WCW pay-per-view Scramble.
Yes. Of course.
Well, you know, I'd do some homework. I'd kick back and just listen to, you know, Tony and Bobby or Tony and Jesse call a show and watch it all scrambled up.
Well, let's move on. I want to go back to the 80s, okay? And I want to just bring up this match just to give a little Texas history lesson here. And then we'll go back to some more famous points. In 1989, on June 9th, Gary Young versus Eric Embry was taped in what became USWA but used to be World Class.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Thunderdome cage match. Not as exciting as it seems. For that name, it's kind of tame. But I want to give a shout out to young Eric Embry, because if you look at the guy, what a scuzzy looking slob. Guy. Oh man, guy that if you turned your head, he stole your wallet out of your pocket. You know, just what a scummy looking character. And he fought another scummy looking character who's straight from the 80s. Gary Young with his permed curly hair and his Magnum PI mustache. Just an 80s reject here. And they had this match, and it's a good match. But more importantly, Eric Embry was one of the best wrestlers in 1989, having great feuds with Young, Jerry Lawler, Bill Dundee, basically keeping that Texas territory afloat until Texas and the USWA Memphis merged. And I just wanted to give a shout out to Eric Embry because of this match that happened. And you can find it on YouTube. Just type in Gary Young versus Eric Embry and look for the match with the cage on it. And you can watch it on YouTube. So
we can
just want to give a shout out to that.
I think you have the link in the email here, right? So we can put that in.
Sure, sure.
You can drop that right in the PCBNation.com.
And I don't even think that's the best match they had, but because it happened on this week, it gave me an opportunity to talk about Eric Embry and the fabulous 1989 he had. So
it's funny because Embry's a guy I only knew from the Aptermags growing up.
Right.
So I didn't read a ton. I mean, they used to write about, you know, Memphis and USWA War Class all the time. So I remember, you know, I've never even seen a lot of it, but I remember vividly the angle where he gets blinded and all that.
Yep.
Just from reading the saga in the monthly PWI.
No, Embry was a great wrestler, man. It had a lot of great matches in Puerto Rico. So if you ever come across some Puerto Rico footage, make sure to check that out as well. But he's a guy that is lost to people. Like if you started watching wrestling 10, 15, 20 years ago, you have no idea who this guy is. You have to be 40 years older, you know, or be someone who is so deep into wrestling like yourself that you're reading the Aftermags to have any clue who this guy was.
Right.
So, you know, anytime I can point out a wrestler like Eric Embry, I'm going to do it because I think people should go back and explore the past to see how we got to where we are today.
Yeah, and I think we had a lot of matches imploring people to go see if they haven't so far tonight. Some of those ones from the first Clash and now this one as well.
Definitely, definitely.
And this one, not a WWE property, so we'll definitely put the YouTube link in the write-up. So, Will, a couple other big WWE-based moments that occurred this week in history.
Yes.
2005 and 6, the one-night stand pay-per-views, the
yes.
ECW reunion. Do you have any memories or thoughts of watching those shows and your feelings about them?
I have mixed feelings. Because I enjoyed the shows. I think the shows are good. I think both pay-per-views are thumbs-up pay-per-views. You know, I'm not even opposed to the way they incorporated WWF wrestlers into those shows. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like the fact that, like, in 2005... they basically gave an open invitation to any old ECW wrestlers. And so to have a show that has Lance Storm and Chris Jericho, right, both who had cut their teeth in ECW, to have Super Crazy and Tajiri and Guido reprise their three-way dance, Rey Mysterio versus Psychosis, Eddie versus Benoit, Awesome versus Tanaka, Dudley Boys with Dreamer and Sandman. None of those matches are five-star matches, but it doesn't matter. It really felt like a great ECW mm-hmm. tribute. And then the next year, a little bit different, because the next year you have Taz defeating Jerry Lawler, which in a way that's kind of cool because Jerry Lawler had been calling it extremely crappy wrestling for 20 years.
Okay. Yeah, right. Yeah.
And he had his feud with ECW in the 90s, which was awesome because it spanned three promotions. It went in USWA, ECW, and WWF. So that was pretty great. But then you have Kurt Angle versus Randy Orton. Whatever. FBI, Full-Blooded Italians versus Tajiri and Crazy, throwback ECW match. Rey Mysterio versus Sabu. This one, Mick Foley, Edge, and Lita versus Terry Funk, Tommy Dreamer, and Beulah. Super fun match. And Balls versus Balls Mahoney versus Masato Tanaka, and RVD versus John Cena. But the way they built it up, it worked.
Right, and I think
it worked.
The difference, there's a couple of differences in the show. So obviously, for the first one was meant to be a standalone one time only. The second one was there to start the brand, start the ECW
right,
brand.
Right.
And to me, the difference of the card is the first one from top to bottom is the better, the more fun, the hotter watch. Like everything
yes.
works, everything clicks. The tributes, Heyman's promo. Remember JBL, you're
yes.
a champion because Triple H didn't want to work Tuesdays. You know, that epic line, the fight with
yes.
the Meanie at the end and JBL. So all that stuff is great. 06 to me, though, has the two best matches when you look at just pure like match rating quality. And that was the Edge six-man, which was great in its own right. And then the Cena RVD match with the insane crowd heat and the great moment with Edge.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with any of that.
So to me, those are the two probably best matches of both shows. But 05 to me is the better overall show just because of how everything stays so hot. But 06 to me has the best moment in Foley's the promo before the match where he's like, I sold out. I sold out Madison Square Garden. You know, like,
yeah.
This fantastic heel work with him, Edge, and Lita. And then, you know, making it the six-person match. And, you know, Beulah kind of finally gets her moment. Just a lot of fun. And seeing Funk back as well. And, you know, say what you want about what they ended up doing with the brand itself, but that night's still something very special, those two ECW shows, and something you never thought would happen. And the fact that in 05, Vince just gave Heyman free reigns to do whatever he wanted was just, like, mind-blowing at the time.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's why I say I have mixed feelings, is because at some point you have to let sleeping dogs lie.
Mm-hmm.
You have to let it just die. And I went through tons of ECW footage. I've collected it. I enjoy it. But like TNA tried to do like their hardcore reunion a couple of years ago, and it felt so tired. And you have Tommy Dreamer coming out with the House of Hardcore reunion shows, and it's like, guys, let it die. You know, just let it rest.
Oh, I think they got in just under the gun with 05. Like, I feel like if they waited any longer, it would have been too late. As it is, they were just
maybe
really on the edge. They were on
the 05, 06, I think they were fine. And to be fair, one of my favorite documentaries was made by my good buddy, John Filipovich, Johnny P, who did the Barbed Wire City documentary, which to me, that was a fitting end, a fitting close to the chapter that was ECW. And that documentary is a documentary that even Steve Austin, every time somebody from ECW is on his podcast, Steve Austin is there asking them if they've seen it and putting over how great my buddy Johnny's documentary is.
Right, and of course, he's been on various shows here at PlaceMination.com as well.
He's been on reaction shows, and he's a great guy. But I want to make this the Johnny P show. But the point is, sometimes, like I can't watch ECW. We're not going to do a card versus card with ECW for a long time because I'm not ready to jump back into remembering ECW because I don't feel like the ECW wrestlers have let me miss it yet.
Right.
I can't miss it if you're never gone. And so it'll be a while before we do any ECW-centered falls here on the Dangerous Alliance pay-per-view podcast.
Someday maybe pay-per-view. No.
Yeah, maybe we'll do a pay-per-view someday for seven fools who part with their cable money. Anyway.
99. So let's go back not as far. 2010 was a major episode of Raw when the Nexus debuted and attacked.
Oh, man.
Such a crazy night, because the last thing you would ever expect. It had been a tepid few weeks on Raw, if I remember correctly, and not really thinking anything big's going to happen, and then all of a sudden these angry kids show up and just lay waste to everyone and everything. The lasting shot, of course, Daniel Bryan choking Justin Roberts with his tie, ended up getting him fired a couple weeks later. He'd eventually return. But the Nexus, really one of the first times they started doing the big summer angle. If you remember, the next year we'd get the pipe bomb, and then, you know, from there we'd go on. But that was really the first time we got that major, big time summer angle that really kind of shook up the promotion and set you up towards SummerSlam.
Man, I'll tell you what. At the time, I was doing my Goodwill Wrestling podcast with Rob Naylor, and Rob had actually just called me that night out of the blue. We were just talking. Hey, what are you doing? Nothing much. Oh, I'm just watching Raw. and I wasn't watching Raw at the time. I don't know why I didn't watch it that night. But all of a sudden, Naylor's screaming at me, bro, turn on your TV, turn it on Raw. You have to see this, like that. And I'd only missed the first few seconds when they actually started the attack, but I got to see the extended beatdown. And we were both talking to each other on the phone. Oh, wow, this is insane. And it was so cutting edge that you wish WWE would go to that well more often, where they would do something cutting edge. The Punk thing was a little bit different because it was kind of a one-man crusade.
Right.
And a lot of the things that Punk wanted to see done, they were never done. But some of it is. Look at NXT today.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a CM Punk vision. Let's bring in the indie guys. Let's bring in guys that can work. Let's bring in guys, you know. I mean, I know Triple H gets all the credit, but if you really think about what the change that Punk was talking about, that's what this is. Bringing in your Jericho's and your Steens or, you know, your Sami Zayn's and Kevin Owens. Those are things Punk wanted. Hey, bring in these guys that can work, that can go. Bring in your Seth Rollins and your Dean Ambrose's. Bring in your guys that can fly. Bring in the guys that bring energy. You know, that these guys that we credit NXT and the excitement that NXT has with it.
And the cool thing with the Nexus is it was guys that weren't names that you didn't know. It was something they'd never done before, having
unknown
Michael Tarver, Darren Young, Otunga. Like, these guys come out and just lay waste. And Dan, you trying to pipe in here?
Heath
Slater was a really good character, eventually developed into a really good character.
So quick trivia question for you here. I don't know if you're looking at it in the email. Do you remember, now we all remember the match where the Outsiders came in, right? It was it the Mauler, Mike Enos versus Steve Dahl or whatever, when Scott Hall comes in.
Yes.
Do you remember the match that was going on in the ring when the Nexus attacked?
Was it John Cena versus CM Punk?
It is Cena. Yep, Cena and Punk. So I mean, kind of forgotten, right?
I remember those two guys being the ones who got beat down. So
right, and they had was during the Straight Edge Society, and it was a poll for fans to vote in to determine Cena's opponent. Punk defeated Ray and Swagger, to face Cena that night, and then. Of course, Wade Barrett wearing an armband with N on it walked to the entrance stage, and then the rest of the crew jumped everyone. Of course, Barrett had won NXT that season to set that up. So,
and what a shame, man! Barrett keeps getting hurt every time they start pushing him. Like, I think he's cursed.
Super nice guy. We met him Rumble weekend at a rest stop in New Jersey, and
wow,
really cool guy.
Well, I don't know. I think that. It's another long line, and we could probably make a game of that. Woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Yeah.
What should the WWE have done? And we could do that with so many things. And the Nexus is one of them. Not saying that all of those guys were world beaters, main eventers, but a lot of them were just never given the chance.
Right.
You know, Hunter doesn't like you. Okay, well, that's why Justin Gabriel asked for his release. You know, he knew he was never going to get a shot under this regime. So he moved on. So it was a shame.
We need to move on as well, because time is up, fellas.
I will just mention, this is a callback to our first episode. John Tenta also passed away this week as well.
Oh, wow. Okay. Rest in peace, John Tenta.
I'm going to call that out. So, all right. That means we are done. The three falls are up. That was a lot of fun, but we do have a little bit more business to take care of, and it is mailbag time. So, Dan McGinn, we're going to set the clock to 15 minutes, do 15 minutes of mail, and I want you, sir, to read us our first one.
We're going to the party. We're going to the game. We're going to the disco. And gonna cruise out, man. We're stealing people's mail. Stealing people's mail.
You've got mail.
All right, guys, we'll start with the mailbag. We're going to go with Jesse Uwiak to start us off. He goes, name one performer who'd be a much bigger star if WCW had survived till now, and then follow that up with one guy who'd be a much lesser star if WCW had survived.
Oh, man. So, Will, I think we're going to set some parameters around this. So, if WCW survives, under what guise are we saying it survived? So, are we saying Bischoff and Fuchsia bought it and they remain in control to this day? Or are we pretending?
I think so. Okay. I think so. Okay. That they get their television deal.
All right. So, they get that their TV deal and it goes well.
Non-Vince product.
Okay. So, it's a non-Vince product led by Eric Bischoff to this day. who's a bigger star and who's a lesser star?
I think in terms of who's a bigger star, I'm going to say a name from the past, Sean O'Hare.
He
was a guy that I thought had a great look, could be led through the ring, but I know when he got to developmental, for whatever reason, they just said this guy doesn't have it, he doesn't know what he's doing, and that they gave up on him. So, but I think that none of that would have mattered in WCW. They would have just let him go out there anyway. I think Sean O'Hare would have been a bigger star. And for a lesser star, you know, this is a guy that WCW had for a long time. And unless he actually jumped to WWE, I think Rey Mysterio wouldn't have has been a big of a star. He would have never been a world champion in WCW.
Here's one I think that would have been a lesser star, and it's going the opposite way, is a guy who I think really got his push and became a big guy because of the brand extension. And I think if WCW still exists, I don't think we go to Raw and SmackDown as separate shows. And that's JBL. We talked about him, you know, getting the push because Triple H didn't want to work Tuesdays. Does he really ever elevate to world championship level if he doesn't get almost a vanity show of his own to run and get a year's worth of title matches in to really build his character?
Very good.
What are your thoughts about Edge? Do you think he ever blossoms? Because, I mean, my world, if WCW exists, we're not getting a SmackDown. Unless you're picturing WCW to toil like TNA, but if they're still alive today and they never went under, I'm thinking they're at least somewhat successful. So I don't think Vince ever creates a separate brand.
I think you're right, but I think Edge survives it because he was kind of one of their chosen ones.
Does he get the run he had, though? Because remember, I mean, he was SmackDown's guy for so long.
I think it just depends. You know, one injury away, buddy. That's all it takes. I don't think guys like Christian ever get a shot. Guys like Rey Mysterio never get a shot.
Right.
Eddie Guerrero, probably not.
Yep. Or does he get Benoit's spot? Do they pick Eddie over Benoit?
Maybe.
He was, you could argue he was hotter.
Yeah, maybe. Who knows? But I'm going to say that Edge still gets to about where he got.
All right. Good question, Justin. Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go to Khawk20, and he talks about a draft pick from earlier today. He goes, Nick Bockwinkel becomes NWA heavyweight champion in 1975 and holds it off and on until Flair wins it in 1981. Book Bockwinkel 6 years on top of the NWA, and what of Harley Race? Book his next 6 years, too. He has a caveat, too, but this question is already long enough. Guys, take it away.
All right. Will, I'm going to defer to you mainly for this one, and I'll try and piggyback on top.
Nick Bockwinkel would have fit in any setting.
Yeah.
He was a great wrestler, great heel. He could have been the traveling NWA touring champion. He could have fought a lot of the guys he already fought. He could have fought Lawler in Memphis in those classic matches. Same outcome. Now you're putting Bockwinkel versus Flair on a regular basis on loops. Oh, they're going to sell out, except they're not going to just sell out in the South or in Minneapolis. I mean, that is a mega matchup for the 70s or 80s. You could put Bockwinkel versus Steamboat in that Carolina territory. You're going to have Harley Race. What do you say? What are you going to do with Harley Race?
Yeah, so you got to book Bockwinkel 6 years on top of the NWA from 75 to 81, and what becomes of Harley Race, you know, who was obviously...
Well, then you just have him trade the belt, you know, or you have Harley run with it occasionally and Bockwinkel occasionally. I don't even think you need Harley in there. I'm perfectly fine keeping the belt on Bockwinkel for all 6 years, kind of making him the working man's Bruno. You know how, like, Bruno held the belt for 8 years or whatever it was? Do that with Bockwinkel, and then whoever beats Bock, and if it's Flair, he is made. He is a made man for beating the super master technician Bockwinkel. I have no problem doing that.
Which route do you think they would have been more successful with, the way they went, or if it would have been Bockwinkel over a race? Or do you think it's interchangeable?
No, I think Bockwinkel's head and shoulders are better than Race. I think he's a better promo. Add Bobby Heenan to the Bockwinkel mix. He's a better worker, better wrestler, more charismatic. I think Bockwinkel has it over Race in almost nearly every single category, except maybe a number of moves you do in a match.
Number of knee drops.
Yeah, exactly. Number of headbutts, fallen headbutts.
All right, I think you summed that one up pretty well, Dan. So I think we go to the next one.
All right, I'm going to Overbooked, who writes, you can only watch one TV show from one promotion until the end of time. Which one do you choose and why?
I got this one first.
All right.
As a Jerry Lawler fan, and knowing that I want to watch wrestling for a long time, I'm going to go with Memphis Wrestling, which appeared in Memphis nonstop, at least from the 1970s all the way till the 1990s. So I have 20 years of wrestling I can watch. So I'm going to go with the Memphis territory, and I'm going to get to watch Jerry Lawler at his peak.
I mean, you know, the fan inside me really wants to say, like, prime time just for the Gorilla Bobby stuff, but there's such a limited catalog there, so it's not giving me much to work with. So I think that leaves me with two options. WWE fan, WWF fan, homeboy. Raw is in my running. There's a lot of bad stuff, but there's also a ton of good stuff in there. And, maybe taken in time to rewatch from the start, you start to appreciate even the more modern stuff that gets kind of dumped on today. The other option would be, NWA, WCW, Jim Crockett, Saturday Night, which ran pretty much from 85 to 01 or 2000.
Oh, Saturday Night was awesome.
So, those are probably my two, if I could cheat. I mean, Saturday Night would give you a ton of programming to fill. I mean, usually 2 hours, tons of great matches. And even at the end, when there weren't big angles going on, remember, it existed in that own little universe Jimmy Hart was booking.
That's right.
And still a lot of good stuff in there with those kind of C-level guys that they had on the contract doing nothing else but just competing on Saturday Night. So my two choices, I guess.
I will say, though, if I could have a second choice, if Bill Watts was able to survive, mm-hmm. Bill Watts TV from 86 to 87 was some of the best TV wrestling had to offer. With that UWF show, giving us marquee matchups long before Nitro and Raw did it. It was just amazing TV for the time, but it didn't last very long. But I would throw that in as a caveat. Next question, there, Dan.
All right, I'm going to go to Stephen Graham so he doesn't cry in his cereal tomorrow up north. Here's a game for you guys: main eventer, bottom of the card, or fire. And the three choices are Roman Reigns, Seth Rollins, or Dean Ambrose.
All right. So it's what? Push to main event. What are they again, Dan?
Push to main event, push to the bottom of the card, or bury, or fire.
So I guess this depends. What do you think is worse, push to the bottom of the card or fire? Because if you're firing them, you're at least letting them go live somewhere else. If you push to the bottom of the card, you are really just kind of stunting the growth and pissing people off.
You're nulling this one, JR. I'm not touching it until after I hear your answer.
This is a hard one, man. It's like picking between your children. All right. Is your goal to entertain yourself or to make money? So, because if I want to make money, all right, that's my objective here. I mean, Reigns has to be the guy you're pushing to the top. I mean, to me, he's the money man. If I'm continuing to want to make money, give me a second. I'm gonna deep push Ambrose because I want to keep him, and I feel like even on the undercard he connects with the fans. And I'm telling Rollins, go make your money somewhere else. And it hurts me to do so because I like Rollins a lot.
But it's a good choice. That was my choice as well. Because you're going to push Reigns to the top. Because, one, I think Reigns can have some really great matches. I think he showed that when he had a very entertaining match with the Big Show earlier this year.
Yeah, and then
the
match of the
year with Lesnar at Mania. Plus, Rollins is a heel. And if you think back to the old territory times, what do you do with the heel after he's been pushed?
Mm-hmm.
You send him away for 6 months or a year so he can come back fresh. And so, and Ambrose, it's not like he wasn't being pushed at the bottom of the card anyway up until this last month or so. So I have no problem doing that whatsoever.
And he's there if you need him, because to me he's the second most likely to make him money. And he at least is still in your card. You know me, Rollins goes and reheats and has a run somewhere else and comes back. But I love all three. I would not want to fire any three of them.
Yeah, there's no reason to fire any of them. So another question. Let's do this.
Something not stupid from some stupid Canadian named Stephen Graham.
How about this one from BP? Because we don't talk TNA too often. Dixie Carter hires you to create a LinkedIn profile for her. How do you spin her history and skills to make her a desirable job candidate?
Two words. Bob Ryder.
What the hell are you talking about?
That's all I'd have on the resume, Bob Ryder. And then you go talk to Bob Ryder.
He sees your reference.
Gush. You would just gush. That's the human resume.
Your references are Bob Ryder, Billy Corgan, and what's her dad's name?
Oh, Vince Russo would be the other one.
No, not anymore.
Swerve, though, Dixie. I'm not going to put you over.
What's her dad's name?
Bob Carter.
Bob Carter. There you go. Bob Ryder, Billy Corgan, and Bob Carter are your references. You have people skills, the ability to lie to people's faces.
Yeah. You can go through the table well.
Yeah, right. Has a impeccable ability to make money disappear. So she's a magician.
She's put aged that on well physically.
There you go.
So you maybe want to have intercourse with her. That would be about something.
Oh, God. Man, she's not going to be on the casting couch. oh, God. Yeah, dude, that's hard, man. I saw that question, and I honestly had no idea. Just the great people skills. I'm trying to think, what else would you put on her resume?
Loyal? She's loyal. I'll give her that. She's loyal. How about that? Very loyal.
If this was the Fox News Network, dislikes minorities behind their back. I don't know. Who would hire her, man? She is so inept. I don't think she gets hired anywhere. I think we failed at answering that question.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, besides being a bangable older lady.
You're right, man.
And being loyal.
But she wasn't loyal when that dude broke his neck.
Yeah, but she's loyal. I mean, like, to Russo all those years, remember? She wouldn't get rid of him no matter what, and... loyalty with Jarrett for a while.
Her vanity is going to be the death of her promotion.
Oh,
she
could
sold the promotion to the country
Jarrett.
Singer.
Well, to Toby Keith. But and then she wanted to stay on as a competitor.
Yeah, man. There's no redeeming qualities.
Tough one.
Come on, we can't end this on a team.
No, we got one more, Dan. We got time for one more here.
All right. Somebody named Parv writes. Best mustache in wrestling. Discuss.
Oh, easy. All right. There are three men who live by their mustaches. All right. The first is Ox Baker.
Yes.
Okay. If you ever seen Ox Baker, the mustache makes the man. Number two, Jake the Snake Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
That's the mustache that he's going to wear for the rest of his life. That's part of his costume. And number three, because it embodied the time he worked in the 80s, my man, Magnum T.A.
Yeah, I mean, he had the kind of the Magnum P.I. going on.
Plus, I mean, again, another guy who never got rid of the mustache. Maybe grew it into a goatee, but, you know, or a beard. But the only other person I can think of is Hogan, because that's pretty much the iconic mustache.
No,
right?
I got one for you. I got one. Tremendous mustache in the vein of Magnum T.A. and the guys of the 80s. And to me, once he shaved it off, never looked the same. Ravishing Rick Rude. Fantastic mustache.
That's true. Him. Another one, Big Scott Hall.
That was where
Holy
I was going
crap.
Next. Scott Hall's AWA mustache. I mean, that was
yes.
I think it was a beast unto itself.
Absolutely true.
How about the Iron Sheik's mustache? That's
Iron
a famous
Sheik's
one.
A good one. The Scott Hall one, though, that mustache itself could probably pin me, you know, could get the three count.
I think you guys are burying the lead here. I mean, he had a shirt about it. He had a chant behind it. It's Cody Rhodes.
Yes, Cody Rhodes. Interesting one. Interesting.
Only because of the era he lived in. He didn't truly believe in it. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Right. Oh, no. Yeah, it was a gimmick, not a lifestyle.
The love stash, baby. The love stash.
It wasn't. Once again, it was a hipster throwback gimmick versus guys who lived the mustache lifestyle.
Like guys who actually went to clubs in the 80s and picked up women because of their mustache and their hairy chests.
It's like,
you know what I mean?
You ever see, was it Going the Distance? You ever see that movie? Either of you guys, Justin Long and Drew Barrymore. Anyway, the whole thing is Jason Sudeikis is one of his friends, and he goes to, he wants to start banging and picking up like cougars or whatever. So he goes to these old, these high school reunions, like 20th reunion and stuff, and he grows a mustache because he wants to remind these women of their time when they were at their sexual peaks in high school. So that's when they were in the 80s. So he grows this big mustache. And Charlie Day is the other friend. He goes and he screws his up and ends up looking like a Hitler mustache. So it's
gosh.
There you go. There's your winner, Hitler.
Yes, Michael Jordan did the Hitler mustache as well. But I think the ones we named are the big ones. I mean, to me, Rude was like the epitome of a man's man.
Man, mustache. I didn't even think Rude, man. I can't even believe I left out Rick Rude.
Killer mustache.
Where's that? Did you guys say Iron Sheik?
Yes, I said Iron
Sheik.
Yes.
Or Big Bully Busick.
Oh, another good one.
Big Bully Busick was a great one, yeah.
He had the old school, like, William Taft mustache.
That's awesome. They should have a wrestler whose whole gimmick is patterned after William Howard Taft. That'd be awesome.
It's plenty of candidates.
Okay. Is that it? Do we have time for another question?
I think
where are we at time-wise?
Oh, we're way over time.
Okay,
but
so we'll wrap. We'll wrap.
Okay.
Episode 2 in the book. So another great time, guys. PlaySimulation.com. Be sure to check it out. Tons of great podcasts for you. Tons of great written pieces as well. We have another special event pay-per-view coming up this weekend. Dan will be doing the preview for Money in the Bank. We'll have our live reaction show. Will, I'm sure. Do you know your lineup yet for that?
I know for sure. Myself, Chris Zellner, Pete, and Johnny Sorrow. I think my buddy Dylan is actually going to celebrate his mom's birthday, I think. So he'll be out, but we might have somebody, maybe a special guest fill in for Dylan this week.
Awesome. And of course, you did one for New Japan, the Best of the Super Juniors Finals. It was up this week as well. Lots of other great podcasts out there for you. Scott and I did Unforgiven 2004, and I don't want to go around tooting horns, but to me, that was one of our best vintage vault episodes in a long time. Some good talk there. So I recommend that one if you're looking at a spot to get in with me and Scott, Place to Be podcast. New XL and Bad Street went back to the indie circuit of the 2000s. Chris is joined by Rob Mailer and Wes Hatch. And now they're looking at some of the competitors, not just the promotions that they did in part one. Pete and Marty on Tag Teams Back Again, episode 6. I have a special tribute to Tommy Rogers, who passed away. We talked about him a little bit earlier. New Kings of Sport, new PTBN main event as well. So be sure to check out all the podcasts, PlaySimulation.com, all our written work as well. If you want to join us on Facebook, Facebook.com/PlaceToBeNation, Place2BNation on Twitter. Be sure to check out as well the ProWrestlingOnly.com message board for some more great wrestling discourse as well. So for Dan McGinn and Will, I am JT. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. We'll be back with episode 3, all new exercises. Get your mailbag questions in, either on the Place of Nation Facebook page or at the thread at ProWrestlingOnly.com. And Dan, I think you have a major announcement. Do you want to make that announcement? Some big news. I mean, there's rumors on Twitter. Do you want to address it here?
There are all kinds of rumors going on
I'm
Twitter.
I'm sorry, we're out of time. That's it. The clock is up, Dan. We'll talk about that soon. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Well, take care. Dan, take care. We're out.